chill, guys. Cheer up. It's a good night, man. You know what I mean? Let's go. Boom, boom, boom. Another one bites the dust.
Another one bites the dust.
Another one bites the dust. And another one
buried.
Another one
buried.
Another one bites the dust.
Buried.
Another got to do. Another one bites the dust.
Berry squash. Berry squash. Berry squash.
There are no such thing as politics in WWE.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered a streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
I call that intro, Triple H loves his fruit. He loves his berries and squash. He's a big fruit fan. Ironically, that's the same song that Triple H was often heard singing backstage throughout the entire decade of the 2000s as he would strut out of booking meetings. And it was funny, somebody tweeted at me when I made that comment during the show. They sent me a link to a story that I had read years ago, and it kind of refreshed my memory and it made me laugh. The famous story of Am I Fucking Going Over? There was an old WWE writer, I think his name is Matthew Randazzo, and he tells the story of having to, back in the day, and this would have been during the Triple H Reign of Terror period, around then in the early 2000s, where he would run the Raw scripts by Triple H, because obviously he was high up on the food chain, so he wanted to see the script, and he wouldn't even really look at the whole thing. He would just be like, am I fucking going over? And if the answer was yes, then he would hand the script back to Randazzo and say, that's all I needed to know. And on the odd occasion where the answer was no, he would get angry, and he would ask, well, what page is it on? And he would flip to that page in the script and then rip it out. And, there's a lot of that going on back then. According to that one WWE writer on the inside, I always laugh when I hear that story. Am I fucking going over? It's great. This is episode 354 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 16th, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. So much great wrestling this week. You had two incredible three-ways, one on Lucha Underground, it was the Phoenix Drago Pentagon Jr. match, and you had the Dolph Ziggler Cesaro Tyson Kidd three-way for the Intercontinental title on SmackDown. Elimination rules. So the old ECW three-way dance concept, not the usual lame WWE triple threats that end in one fall. Just an awesome, awesome match. Tyson Kidd is just firing on all cylinders these days. One of the few positives, really, I think, to come out of Total Divas is the exposure that this guy has been getting, and it's just absolutely all because of Total Divas, because they did nothing with this guy for years, and suddenly he's on a reality show with his wife, playing the role of shitty husband, and he's getting all this TV time. I say good. It's about damn time. And as much as I like Cesaro, I think it would be cool to see it come down to Tyson Kidd and Dolph Ziggler. I think that's a program I can endorse. I could absolutely see Tyson Kidd as the arrogant heel champion who cares more about his title than his own wife. I want to see more of those two. That's what I want to see. And then on NXT, not a bad match to be found, including the Neville Zayn NXT Championship match, which was insanely good. I say good, not great, and that's not a knock on the match either, because I know that they're saving their best for that NXT special next month. But this is a match worth going out of your way to see. You know, just a ton of great wrestling this week. If all you watch is Raw, you are really selling yourself short. There is life outside of the WWE bubble. There's life inside of the WWE bubble, if you know where to find it, and we saw some of that this week. But there's also life outside the bubble. You know, Ring of Honor has its final battle pay-per-view coming up in about 3 weeks. I'll be there for that. New Japan, which I'm going to talk about in a second, has its big Tokyo Dome show coming up on January 4th on pay-per-view for the first time. Lucha Underground, which if you don't have the El Rey Network, you can easily find by searching around online. So, I mean, if you don't like what you're seeing on Monday nights, and based on your emails and your tweets and your feedback, I know a lot of you don't. If you're pissed off about cats and bunnies and bulls, give these other products a chance. You will quickly realize that there is plenty of good wrestling out there to be found. Even Impact. Impact has been pretty good lately. It's just a dead product. Can't really get too excited for it. But I can't say the recent shows have been bad. In some cases, they've been better than Raw. So you just got to know where to look. But there's plenty of good wrestling out there. Audible is running a special offer for this podcast, and that is that if you sign up right now with our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster, if you put that URL in and then from there sign up, you will get 30 days of free service. You can browse around. There's 150,000 plus different titles, wrestling, non-wrestling titles. I mean, they have tons of books that you can choose from. You get one free book to pick that you get to keep no matter what. So it's a win-win situation. I think most of you guys will probably like the service, but, you know, give it a shot. Don't just take my word for it. Sign up and check it out. Get your free book. You have nothing to lose. If you have not yet read the book, Chris Jericho's new book, The Best in the World at What I Have No Idea, is available through Audible. They have it's almost 12 hours in length, the audio version of the book, but you can actually pick it up using our custom URL for free. All you got to do is sign up for the free trial, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up and you can pick up Jericho's new book for free. I'm about halfway through the book right now myself. I'm really enjoying it so far. I do hope to still get a review done of the book in the next few weeks once I finish it. But so far, it's thumbs up. I've enjoyed all of Jericho's books so far. Again, I'm not done with this one yet. But you can actually get the audio version right now for free. Otherwise, you got to pay over $30 for it. Guess what? You don't have to. All you have to do is use our URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Type in Chris Jericho or just type in The Best in the World at What I Have No Idea. The book should come up. And it's yours, just like that. And just make sure you use our URL when you do so. You can also support the podcast by making a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. The PayPal box is on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. Thank you to Adam the Maniac Massaglia, Craig Pitbull Brown, the Reflection of Perfection Abraham Lara, Tori All I Do Is Win Johansson, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Lord Have Mercy Versi Jones, the Marietta Mahler Alexandru Mata, and Kevin the Promise Thomas. Thank you guys so much for making a donation this week. You don't know how much I appreciate that. TheSolomonster.com is the place to go if you want to make a direct PayPal donation. That is still the best, most direct way to show your support for the Sound Off. And you could also buy a shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tee store, ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster. Sounds off. We have 10 different designs up in the store right now as I record this, although a little birdie flew by earlier and told me that there could be a new one on the way later this week. I don't know. That's unconfirmed. But right now we have 10 different shirts up there. We're doing real well. I want to do even better. I want to do better than everybody else. But I need your help to do that. So if you go on there, check out what we got. Buy one shirt. Buy two shirts. Hell, you're helping out the podcast when you do so. And I think you'll like some of the designs. So ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster sounds off is the place to go. Want to lead off with a big story this week. In my opinion, maybe the biggest. And that is the announcement that good old JR, perhaps the greatest play-by-play man in the history of pro wrestling, Jim Ross, is returning to pro wrestling announcing for the Global Force Wrestling / New Japan Pro Wrestling pay-per-view live from the Tokyo Dome in Tokyo, Japan on January 4th. Now, this is big. Not completely unexpected. There were a lot of rumors about this for some time, but now that it's official, I am very much excited. I mean, I was already excited for the New Japan show, planning on buying it. It's their first traditional pay-per-view offering here in the U.S., not, you know, just iPay-per-view. But this, to me, just puts it over the top. If I wasn't sold on this show already, which I was, now I am for sure. Now, for those of you who don't know all the details, we're still not quite sure exactly what is going on with Jeff Jarrett's Global Force Wrestling. There are rumors that in the next couple of months, he himself will make some announcements about talent and where they will tape TV. They are supposed to run as their own kind of wrestling brand, but what they've been doing is they've been forming partnerships with different organizations and indies all over the world, and not just indies, but, you know, a huge organization, arguably maybe the number two wrestling promotion in the world right now in terms of business, that being New Japan Pro Wrestling. And they brokered this deal with New Japan and with the cable companies to carry the New Japan show on pay-per-view. So it's a little awkward because the name of the show technically is, you know, Global Force Wrestling presents New Japan Pro Wrestling. It's a little convoluted. I like it just because I can now watch a New Japan show on pay-per-view. I mean, hell, you know, what's not to like about that? As far as GFW itself, it's still a little murky exactly what form it will take, but the event will be airing live as it airs in Japan. So as the event takes place in Japan, again, the time zone difference, when you take that into account, the live first run airing is going to be airing at 2 o'clock in the morning, Eastern Time, which is 4 p.m. in Tokyo. The show is supposed to be 4 hours, which is actually less than usual. These shows usually go every bit of 5 hours, maybe sometimes closer to six, which sounds like a lot. You know, we complain, I complain about, 3 hours of Raw. But, you know, when you have wrestling done right, it doesn't have to be as tiring. I still think sitting there for 5 hours straight is probably too much, but they're going to have to keep this show within that four-hour window, so I hope that doesn't sacrifice the quality of some of the matches. I would imagine a lot of the undercard matches will have to lose some time that they normally would not lose, because this is such a loaded lineup, which we'll get to in a second. There's just so many big matches that those top four, five matches, you can't really cut from those matches. So you're going to have to cut from somewhere else. I don't know how they're going to do it, but hopefully it doesn't sacrifice the quality and integrity of the show, because I think everybody should be able to watch a Wrestle Kingdom show. And this is the 24th installment, I believe. This is like their WrestleMania. It's their big annual New Year's event in the Tokyo Dome. 40, 50,000 people packed in there. They have their biggest matches. And now they've got Jim Ross on commentary, doing the American commentary. He will have a broadcast partner. There's a lot of rumors it's going to be Mike Tenay. Although with some, you know, TNA developments this week and some news that may be breaking on the TV front, it's possible that Tenay won't do the show. He may re-sign with TNA. I believe his deal is either up or just about up. So he will have to re-sign. And he may well re-sign with TNA. If he does that, I can't see him being allowed to do the Tokyo Dome show. If he doesn't, he may very well be there doing commentary with Jim Ross. And that would be, to my knowledge, the first time that Mike Tenay and Jim Ross have ever been broadcast partners. If he goes back to TNA, who would it be? You know, some people say, oh, CM Punk. You know what? Never say never. I don't see it happening. I know that Punk probably still has an affinity for New Japan. He name-dropped them in that pipe bomb promo many years ago. Maybe the opportunity to go broadcast one show and do a show with Jim Ross over in Japan. Who's to say? Who's to say that isn't something Punk would be interested in? I think Punk just has gotten out of the wrestling bubble completely. I don't see it happening, but you never know. So if it's not Tenay, who would it be? I can't even speculate beyond those two names. I have no idea. What I like about it, though, is that you do have the option, if you want to, of listening to the Japanese commentary. Now, I watch a lot. The only New Japan I watch, really, is online, obviously. That's the extent that I am exposed to it. So whenever they have big shows, I try to watch what I can, and the matches will float around on YouTube or Daily Motion, and I try to take in as much of it as I can. I mean, I will watch as much of it as I can because I enjoy it that much, and the Japanese commentary does not take away from it for me. Like, if this pay-per-view is strictly Japanese-only commentary, I could see that being a turnoff for a lot of people, and you can't really do that if you're breaking into the American market. You've got to have the option, at least, for American announcing. But you can switch between the two using the SAP option on your television, which I think is really cool. So you will have the choice. If you don't want to listen to Jim Ross and his partner doing the show, if it's just not a good fit or you just want to keep the Japanese commentary, you can do that. Not me. My television is so old it doesn't even have a SAP button, so I don't have that option. But most of you with televisions that were made in the last 10 years probably do. So I think that's really cool. Wherever you may be, you should have it available to you. It's on DirecTV, Dish, AT&T, U-verse, Comcast, Verizon Fios, I think pretty much every cable system in this country. So this is your chance if you've never seen New Japan before. What a hell of a way to see New Japan for the first time. This is going to be a big, big show. And it's a show that goes back, like I said, well over 20 years. A lot of big names, big American names have appeared on this event before. Hulk Hogan is one. Sting, Vader, Randy Savage, Brock Lesnar, who at one point after he left WWE became the IWGP champion. great Muta and, you know, Chono and all those guys. Let's run down the card really quickly here, just to give you a sense of some of the big matches that are taking place. Obviously, the key match is the main event. It is Hiroshi Tanahashi and Kazuchika Okada for the IWGP title. Probably the two biggest names in New Japan, two of the biggest names and best wrestlers in the entire world. And they have had a rivalry now that has stretched back many years. They've had a whole series of matches. And unlike John Cena and Randy Orton, you know what? Even Tanahashi and Okada has not been done to death as much as something like Cena Orton. But even if it was, the big difference is that when Tanahashi and Okada go in there, you know exactly what you're getting. They're going to go in there, and they have the potential to not only have the best match on the show, but possibly one of the best matches of all time. I mean, who knows if they will or not, but that's the caliber of talent you're dealing with here. Whereas with Cena Orton, you don't really expect that. So I don't mind the fact that, you know, these guys have had a whole bunch of matches, now they're going to have another one. This may be their best yet. This could very, and Jim Ross made this comment. He did an interview this past week and said, I am broadcasting, this main event that I'm broadcasting on January 4th could very well, and think about this, think about the length of his career, all the classic matches he's called. I'm almost positive that he must have called at least one of the Flair Steamboat matches, Austin Rock, all these big iconic matches in history. And Jim Ross says this could end up being the biggest, greatest main event I've ever called. And, you know, you could say, well, he has to say that, he has to hype up the show, but I think he believes that, and I think there is the potential for this to be the greatest main event that he's ever called, and that covers a lot of ground. So this is a big-time match between Tanahashi and Okada. We have Shinsuke Nakamura and Kota Ibushi for the Intercontinental title. We have Taguchi against Kenny Omega, who recently hooked up with New Japan. He is now a member of the Bullet Club faction. They'll be wrestling for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. Big-time tag team four-way match with Red Dragon, Bobby Fish, and Kyle O'Reilly, who I believe they're the Ring of Honor tag team champions, taking on the Forever Hooligans, Alex Kozlov and Rocky Romero, the Time Splitters, Alex Shelley and Kushida, and the Young Bucks, Nick and Matt, for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team titles. We have Tomohiro Ishii against Togi Makabe for the NEVER Openweight title, and Minoru Suzuki against Kazushi Sakuraba, knockouts and submissions only. This is going to be a brutal match. I haven't even seen it yet. I can tell you right now, you are going to cringe and wince many times, and probably cheer quite a bit as well during that match. It's always fun to watch two guys just go in there and beat the piss out of each other. That's what that match is on the card for. There's a lot of other matches. Those are the key ones right now. And so I'm very excited for this. I really am. And as we get closer to the event on January 4th, I'll probably talk about it more and do a more in-depth rundown when we get closer and then a review post-show. So that's something to look forward to. But if you've missed Jim Ross, if you want to hear him back in his environment where he belongs, calling pro wrestling and not just telling stories and being made fun of and mocked, just JR out there doing what he does best, you know, doing what he was put on this planet to do. You got one more chance to do that on January 4th. The other big news this week, the Great Khali is gone from WWE. They opted not to renew his deal when it expired. Khali now is over 40 years old. It is a miracle that he has lasted this long in the ring. His body has obviously been breaking down for a number of years. He can barely walk, let alone just wrestle. And I think, look, people have asked me, what do you think about this? What do you think about Great Khali being let go, being fired, whatever? He wasn't really fired. They just let his contract lapse. I don't want to sit here and say, oh, thank God, you know, because the guy lost his job. That'd be a shitty thing for me to do. Unless he was just really that bad of a person, then I wouldn't mind it so much. I get the impression Khali's a nice guy. People who work in the company seem to like him and are probably sad that he's not there anymore. He was always a fun presence in the locker room. And so, you know, I don't want to hate on the guy. I'm sure, like I said, he's a nice person, but he had no business being on that roster. He had no business being signed in the first place. He was signed as a freak show attraction because Vince has a hard-on for big guys. And in his defense, Khali is a freak of nature. He is one of those people, as, you know, I'm sure Vince loves, when they walk through an airport or they're out in public, people will stop in the street and stare, and they'll say, whoa, look at this guy. Look at this guy. And may even be scared and intimidated by his presence, even though I'm sure he's a teddy bear in real life. So that's why he was signed. He had a World Heavyweight Championship run, which I'm sure still makes Batista want to retch and vomit. I think Batista made a... It was Batista who made a comment once upon a time about being disgusted by Kali being champion. He was just completely revolted by that. As we were by many of his matches. He just was not very good. There were some people who could carry Kali to an acceptable match. I dare say I have never one time seen the great Kali in what I would truly call a good match. And I know he had a match one time on pay-per-view with John Cena, and I think it ended with Cena giving him the attitude adjustment off the stage or something. And as I remember, that match probably had no business being as decent as it was, but I don't remember that even being that good of a match. The guy never had a good match. And he just took up space on the roster at a time when you would hear about this guy getting cut or this girl getting cut. This person's gone. That person's gone. And yet somehow, Kali would always outlast them. And you can never really figure out why other than, well, he's big. He's big, so we'll keep him around. Plus, they were using him in comedy segments. And there's a place for that on the show. But, you know, he outlasted his stay. He got way more time there than I think anybody expected him to. So he had a good career for himself. Not a Hall of Fame career, but a career nonetheless. And I wish him the best, but I can't say that I'm devastated by the news of Great Khali being gone. You know, you got to cut the dead weight at some point. And that's what Khali was at this point. He was dead weight on the roster. And you got to make room for guys that you're actually going to do stuff with. They weren't doing anything with him, so they didn't renew his deal. Makes sense to me. We also want to talk about this Randy Savage DVD that's coming out this week. I think they've done a poor job of advertising it on TV, although I expect that this Monday night we'll see at least one commercial for it, because it comes out on Tuesday here in this country. I think it's out earlier than that. It's probably out tomorrow in Canada and other places. This, unlike the previous Savage DVD they released, will have a documentary. And from what I've heard about it, because people have review copies, they've watched it, they've seen it, it's actually very good. It's getting rave reviews from people, and they really took the time and the effort to make this something more than just a compilation of his best matches. Although there are a ton of matches on there. It's a three-disc set. I believe it's the documentary on the first disc with some extras and then matches on disc two and three. You can find the match listing if you want to know what matches are on there. Just go on Amazon or any of the WWE DVD news websites that are out there, and you can get the listing. One thing that I think is interesting, and this is why I'm really curious to be, you know, watching this thing, is there is a chapter on the DVD that does not come outright and say what has been rumored for many years, but they kind of allude to the rumors of Stephanie McMahon and Randy Savage, and they talk about comment, and I believe they even have the video of Savage that was up on YouTube many years ago. It may still be on YouTube. I remember this would have been back around 2000 or something, 2001. Savage was launching or relaunching his website, MachoMan.com. And again, maybe my memory is fuzzy on this, but I think he was launching or relaunching his website, and he was doing these videos where it would be him in the gym with the camera aimed at him, and he would just, you know, he was cutting promos on people. And Triple H may have made a comment about him being old or something during an interview at some point. That really ticked off Randy Savage. So he went off on Triple H. He said, you know, you better be careful. I'm going to steal your girl. He made some comments about Stephanie. I think they actually have that video in the documentary from what I've read. And they, you know, they interview Lanny Poffo and Dusty Rhodes. And they're talking about the rumors that have been out there for years that Triple H had a relationship with an underage Stephanie McMahon. The rumor is that whatever happened when Stephanie was, I think, 17. It would have been around 1993, maybe 94, which was when Savage left the company. And then whatever may have happened obviously did not, you know, was not made known to Vince McMahon until many years later, because it wasn't like Savage was persona non grata immediately after he left, or that's why he left the company. I remember there being rumors back in 1998 and 99 that Savage might be negotiating to come back to WWE. I don't know how far those negotiations got. Whatever happened to make Vince just completely shut this guy out, it happened many, many years after he left the company, as far as making him aware of what may have happened. And I always thought it was bullshit. I just chalked it up to some bullshit rumor that probably started many years ago on an internet bulletin board somewhere or a message board. And I still feel like it may have been something like that. But here on this DVD, and again, we'll see it when it comes out, but I'm going based off what people have said, they're talking about this thing in such a cryptic way that it almost lends legitimacy to it. Like, you don't even have to address it. Just ignore it. If it's a completely disgusting, unfounded bullshit internet rumor, either ignore it or just put this thing to bed once and for all and have an interview on there with Stephanie McMahon saying, yeah, I've read the things on the internet and it's a flat out lie. Randy was always nice to me and my family, blah, blah, blah. I don't think Stephanie is interviewed on this thing at all. And they didn't do that. And not only did they not do that, but apparently they bring it up in a roundabout kind of way. And, like, that segment fades to black very cryptically with a photo of, like, Savage and Vince together and with the message, like, we'll never truly know what happened. And that's, like, I read that and I'm like, wow. Wow. And that makes me think, you know what? Maybe there is something to it. Who's to say? Who's to say? So I'm very curious how they handle this on that DVD. That to me makes it a must-see all by itself. The fact that they would even allude to that on one of their own official DVD releases. It's pretty incredible stuff, so I can't wait to get my hands on that. Monday Night Raw this past week was, I say live, it didn't air live, but it was live on tape. It was a tape-delayed version of Raw here in the States that emanated from Liverpool, England, the same place that Vince McMahon said sounds like an old man's skin disease. That's what he said when he came out during the SmackDown tapings on Tuesday in a dark segment and got all pissy at the crowd for not reacting, and how do you react in a situation like that? You insult the town, so only Vince. So John Cena was out to open the show this week and let us know that he found two men for his Survivor Series team, and those two men are Jack Swagger and Dolph Ziggler. And I knew right away there isn't a prayer Swagger is making it to the pay-per-view. It's just not happening. And sure enough, in the very next segment, he was dispatched by Seth Rollins and two curb stomps. We all know Seth Rollins makes movie stars with that move, so I'm just waiting to see what film they've got in mind for Swagger. See, the problem with Swagger is this, and I said this on Twitter. Swagger, who was actually over 3 months ago during the feud with Rusev, and a lot of that had to do with Rusev and not so much Swagger, but nonetheless, Swagger was over more so during that period than at any other time during his career, and he's been around for a long time, going back to the sci-fi days of ECW. And the problem with Swagger is that for all the times he fell short against Rusev, we had JBL constantly telling us on commentary what a loser this guy was. You let down 318 million Americans, you're a loser, you're not a patriot, and all this stuff, week after week after week, loss after loss after loss. And I'm not even saying he should have beaten Rusev. I'm not saying that at all. But there's a way to tell that story without completely burying the guy on commentary. And I don't use that word very often, but in terms of kayfabe, okay, we're talking storyline here. The guy's character, he was completely buried on commentary by JBL week after week. And I don't want to hear this nonsense. Well, JBL's the heel commentator. He's like the modern-day Bobby the Brain Heenan. He's not. He's not always a heel commentator. He's not out there doing a shtick like you would see back in the 80s or back in the 90s. In fact, I would even argue, and by no means am I comparing them quality-wise, because Jesse Ventura is at the top of anyone's list, as far as I'm concerned. He's at the top of that list, right up there with Bobby Heenan and all those guys. But I think in terms of being a commentator, I would more equate JBL to a Jesse Ventura than a Bobby Heenan. Bobby Heenan was strictly a heel. There's a conflict of interest. His own guys were wrestling on the show. At one point, he managed like 50 different guys. So he's on commentary endorsing his own guys, and when he's not, he's making fun of Tito Santana, oh, the flying jalapeno, and, you know, he's making fun of the Big Boss Man and his mom and Virgil and Tatanka and all these different things. And that was his deal. He was very good. He was very funny at it. Gorilla Monsoon was the perfect straight man. Jesse Ventura, he could do that. You know, he can kind of mock the baby faces, and he could talk trash all the time about Hulk Hogan. But the thing with Jesse was he could also be the voice of reason. There were plenty of times when I found myself, even as a young fan, agreeing with what he was saying. I'm like, hey, you know what? He's got a point. Even though Monsoon, of course, would be like, ah, oh, you're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. And Monsoon was as biased as the heel announcers were. You know, it was always, oh, if Hulk Hogan raked somebody's eyes, Ventura would have a freak fit. How can you condone this, Monsoon? It's okay for, you know, Hogan to do it, but it's not okay for DiBiase to. And Monsoon's response was always like, well, turnabout is fair play. And I'm like, bullshit. But he was a very good straight man sometimes in that way, where Ventura would at least sometimes make sense. JBL, believe it or not, sometimes does make sense. He's not just a straight heel commentator. So when he's out there talking about how Swagger's a loser, Swagger's a loser, Swagger's a loser, after a while you start to believe, you know what? He's right. Swagger's a loser. I watch this guy on television every week, and he loses. He passes out. He taps out. Whatever the case may be. So, to me, that was the biggest problem of all when it came to Swagger, and even for that one segment, trying to buy into the fact that this guy would actually be on Team Cena at Survivor Series and could be perceived as this great threat. Ooh, Jack Swagger's on his team. Surely they have victory well in hand. Like, bullshit. I didn't buy it for a second. In the very next segment, they proved me right. He got taken right out of the match. So they announced this, and it's like, and now we're supposed to care all of a sudden? It didn't work. Cena also tried to convince Ryback to join his team. The Authority came out with Mark Henry, so he's in for Survivor Series. Stephanie tried to convince Ryback to join their team, and in the end he said, John Cena doesn't sign my checks, and then he laid him out with a spine buster. And they would meet later on in the main event. Stephanie had a great line during the show. It was during a backstage segment with Rusev and Lana. You heard it at the top of the podcast. There are no politics, she says. In WWE. That may be the line of the year. So we got a Rusev victory celebration with the Russian national anthem. They were singing the song. Sheamus, disrespectful ass that he is, comes out to interrupt. That leads to a rematch for the U.S. title, Sheamus against Rusev, which Rusev won by countout. And what happened is the Authority had dispatched the Stooges, Mercury and Noble, out there to distract Sheamus and prevent him from getting back into the ring in time. And that was his rematch. That was his one and only rematch. And he should have to go right back down to the bottom of the ladder as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to see him coming out there again and getting another title shot and another until he finally wins it back. I never understood that. You know, how many times did we see that with Batista back in the day on SmackDown when he was fighting for the World Heavyweight title and he won the title like six times? Every fucking month it was another Batista title shot. And it's like, after a while, like, if you're the champion and you lose the title, you are entitled to a rematch, right? That's been the rule forever in this company. Fine. I can live with that. I'm not thrilled with. I don't know where this rematch clause came into play, but whatever. You get a rematch and you lose, or even if you win the match but not the belt, that's it. You go back to the end of the line. But no, they would feed him title shots month after month after month, and it's like, to me, eventually, you're going to win the championship back, just by sheer numbers. So what's so impressive about that? I mean, shit, if I lose my title and then I want to get my belt back and I get my rematch and I fall short, but then I get five more rematches and I finally, on try number five, win the belt back, what's so freaking impressive about that? We'll just keep giving this person title shots until they get their belt back. I don't want to see this nonsense anymore. Sheamus lost. He needs to go back to the end of the line. They need to move on and let Rusev defend his title against somebody else. Hopefully this was the last of Sheamus and Rusev, which is not to say they had a bad match. They actually had a pretty good match, one of the best, if not the best, on the entire show. And I was a big fan of their match on the network the week before. These two guys can go. But just in terms of making sense of who fights for the title and who gets a title shot, this needs to be the end of it. Back in the Attitude Era, when Stone Cold got screwed out of the championship by Vince McMahon, and the title was vacant, and then eventually The Rock won it. That was when The Rock turned heel and became the corporate champion at Survivor Series. Austin got his title shot, his rematch, the very next night on Raw. I remember that match, too, because the crowd atmosphere that night was incredible. If you can find that match on YouTube, it's specifically The Rock-Austin match the night after Survivor Series in 1998. I defy you to find me a hotter crowd. I mean, that was the pinnacle right there. You had those two guys in the ring together, all the corporate guys outside. They had a fuck finish in that match. I remember being incensed over that finish. I couldn't believe that The Undertaker came out and hit Austin in the face with a shovel. And we had a DQ finish in that match. I was so pissed at The Undertaker. It worked on me. But the point is, Austin got screwed. He lost the match. That was his rematch. It's not like the very next week or the very next month, Austin challenged The Rock for the title. He moved into a feud with The Undertaker, and he had to work his way back up to eventually getting his championship rematch against The Rock, which he did at WrestleMania. That's how it should be done. I use that as the template. So the Stooges help out Rusev win. It's kind of like, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine kind of thing. That was their way of trying to convince Rusev to join Team Authority at Survivor Series, which he did. And so he's officially a member of that team. They had a match on this show. It was The Miz and Damian Mizdow against Los Matadores. And they did... it's obvious that they're building tension between Miz and Mizdow, because Mizdow is so much more over than Miz, it's not even funny. He was one of the most over people on the entire show. And to Miz's credit, what they had him doing in this match was actually kind of clever, where he could tell people, you know, were cheering for Mizdow more than him. And he would tease, like, oh, you want me to tag him? You want me to tag him? And people would go nuts. And like a good heel, the Miz did not give the people what they wanted, and he kept wrestling and got booed for it. So that was actually a good heel move by the Miz. I like that. I also kind of like the finish of the match, because it was a nod back to a famous finish from one of the WrestleMania shows, which was WrestleMania 5. It was not Randy Savage. It was Ultimate Warrior and Rick Rude for the Intercontinental title. Bobby Heenan on the outside managing Rick Rude. As Warrior is going to suplex Rude back into the ring, Heenan grabs Warrior's foot. He trips and falls backwards. Rude falls on top of him. The referee does not see Heenan continuing to hold down on Warrior's foot outside the ring, and Rude gets the pin. This, I don't know if this was botched or just a different variation of that finish. It was the old Bobby Heenan finish for Mania 5, but I don't think Mizdow tripped up the Matador. I think Miz just fell on top of the guy, and at that point, Mizdow reached up and held down the Matador's boot, and Miz got the pin. So I don't know. I like that. I looked at that and I said, hey, it's the Bobby Heenan finish. Kinda, sort of. So, I love Mizdow. We had Dolph Ziggler coming out for a match, and in the middle of his entrance, they played the weird eye promo that they've been showing the last couple of weeks with all the eyeballs and this guy talking. It's obviously for Luke Harper, which would play into the final scene of the show. We had a match between Dolph Ziggler and Mark Henry that was horrendous. This was a terrible match. This was as botchtastic a match as you will ever see on this show. It was one botch after another. Henry... And it's all on Mark Henry, as far as I'm concerned. I don't blame Dolph Ziggler for this. Their styles just didn't mesh well, and Henry was falling down in spots awkwardly. It was very bad. Matthew will have a field day with this match for his next Botchamania video. Ziggler got the win by DQ. Henry hit him with a chair, and he was going to do the World's Strongest Slam on Ziggler on the steps like he did to Big Show when Big Show ran out to make the save, and then Big Show announced that he would be on Team Cena at Survivor Series. I am not all that enthusiastic about Big Show being on the team, but it does make sense. You know, and Big Show even made that comment later on backstage in a segment. He goes, look, I got my own history with the Authority, and it's true. Think about where we were 1 year ago. The Big Show was being positioned as the biggest star in the entire company, not Daniel Bryan. It was the Big Show. And he was getting big-time reactions every single week. The Authority, I think, fired him at one point. He showed up in street clothes, and he knocked out Triple H, and I thought it was leading to a Big Show Triple H match. It never did. It did lead to Big Show getting a championship main event at Survivor Series against Randy Orton last year, which was unbelievably bad. Unbelievably bad, and just in terms of that would be the main event they would book. I don't think the match itself was... Actually, the match itself may have sucked. I don't even remember the exact match itself. I just remember the fact that Big Show and Randy Orton was headlining Survivor Series was a fucking joke. But nonetheless, he does have that history with the Authority. It does make sense for him to be on Team Cena. We had another vignette for A New Day. A New Day is coming. This time it featured Kofi Kingston, so I imagine we get one with Big E this week, and then they will finally make their way to television as a unit. I don't know what form this unit will take, if they're going to come down to the ring dancing, if they're going to... be preacher men. Obviously, they're not going to be heels. They're going to be baby faces. So we'll see. See how it goes. They re-aired the segment from SmackDown the week before with Sergeant Dan Rose walking with the exosuit device, which was awesome. It's awesome every time I watch it. And I talked to my friend who only watches casually, and even he said, he goes, dude, I got to be honest with you. I was kind of tearing up during that segment. Nobody I've talked to has said otherwise. Everyone who watched that segment, you can't help but not be affected by that. So that was awesome. We got a segment backstage later in the show where Team Cena came together. It was Cena, it was Ziggler, Big Show was there. Sheamus just wandered by and said, I'll be on your team. So their team appears to just about be set. Ryback is not officially on Team Cena. I imagine it will be made official on television this week. And then the women's match, it was the Divas champion AJ Lee beating Brie Bella with the Black Widow. Match was over, so Nikki Bella attacked AJ with the Rack Attack and posed with the championship to build up their match at Survivor Series. I gotta say, I don't mind the Bella stuff so much right now. Not because I like it, not because it's any better than it was a month ago, it's not. But I can tolerate it now because of how much they've de-emphasized the angle. They've actually de-emphasized the thing so much that it's kind of surprising to me. It looked like the Bella thing was kind of their go-to angle. They were having fun booking it, and they were, in many ways, the focal point, or the number two angle, on the show for weeks and weeks and weeks. Awful acting all around. Just terrible, god-awful shit. And now it's just another angle on the show they give 2 minutes to every single week. I can't be offended by it. It's just another segment on the show. Nikki Bella really is not that bad. Brie Bella still sucks as an actress. She's not that bad in the ring either, but acting, that's a whole other story. So it's inoffensive to me. It doesn't bother me. I'm okay with it now because they've de-emphasized it. That, to me, was my biggest issue with it, besides the bad acting and the corniness of it. It was so much time that they were devoting to this. It's like, enough already. It's embarrassing. Now they get 2 minutes every single week, and it's like, okay, that's about as much time as they probably should devote to this thing, but I'm just stunned. I'm stunned they've put it on the back burner. I don't know why they've done that. I'm happy, but I wonder, maybe they just got bored with it. You would think, given the stipulation with Brie losing that match and having to be Nikki's slave, they would have had fun with it, and they had all these different vignettes planned of, you know, Nikki just torturing her sister and making her do embarrassing things, and they really haven't done that. It's actually been pretty paint-by-numbers stuff that they've done with this angle, with this stipulation. It's almost been a waste. Tyson Kidd had a match with Adam Rose, and Tyson Kidd won off the distraction from the Bunny. Still building heat between Adam Rose and the Bunny. We all know where this is headed. Obviously, it's headed to a match between Adam Rose and the Bunny. When, I don't know. Maybe Survivor Series. Who the hell knows? But they're still building something there. I don't know if they're turning Adam Rose heel, if the Bunny's going to turn heel and finally reveal himself. I have no idea. My guess is that Adam Rose turns heel. You would think the Bunny has to... Is unmask the right word for it? Dehead himself, perhaps? Behead? The Bunny will have to behead himself at some point. That's an awful visual. I just love the fact that Tyson Kidd's on a freaking win streak. And actually, if you look at the triple threat match that he had with Ziggler and Cesaro on SmackDown, they actually had Cesaro be the first person eliminated in that match, which is not a surprise. But they had Kidd be the one to beat him. So if you count that as a fall, even though in the end Kidd lost the match, he was on quite a roll over the last few weeks. And I want to see more of it, because Tyson Kidd is quite awesome. They had a Bray Wyatt promo on the TitanTron, you know, typical Bray Wyatt promo where he's in the back in the shadows somewhere, cutting a promo on Dean Ambrose, very dark promo. And I have to say, you know, I really wish they would cut the crowd audio during Bray's promos. This is not the first time I've said this. I've made this comment before. I make this comment about a lot of backstage stuff they do. You can't cut the crowd out of everything, but there are segments like this that I think are better if you do cut the crowd audio out of it. And I made that comment on Twitter, and boy, a lot of you have really soured on Bray Wyatt based on your reactions when I put that tweet up. A lot of people were like, no, this is great. It exposes how bland and boring his promos are. They need to keep the crowd audio and show how bored and indifferent they are. There's a lot of people out there who are very bored and turned off by the same repetitive Bray Wyatt promos over and over and over again. They are kind of repetitive, I'm not going to lie. I still like Bray as a promo. He just has to, I don't know, he's got to shake it up a little bit. And I don't know how he does that given his current character. So I can see where some of those people are coming from, but I think there was way too much hate on Bray for the promo. And I still maintain they got to cut the crowd noise out because it affects the show. It affects the show. And here's the other thing, and I've commented on this before, and it's one of those little Kevin Dunn things that drives me fucking nuts. And it's whenever there's a backstage segment with the Authority talking to Randy Orton, or it's an interview, whatever, any kind of backstage segment, they have this thing where they cut to the crowd. and they show the backs of everyone's head as either they're looking at the Titantron, or more often than not, they're looking down at their phone because they don't give a shit about what they're watching on the screen, which is even worse when you see people are clearly not paying attention. I don't understand why they want to show the crowd being engaged, I guess. It's one of the dumbest production things they do. It's a little thing. I nitpick it, but I hate it when they do that. And they started doing it a few years ago, and it just drives me nuts whenever they do it. Like, what is the point? It takes you out of the moment. When I'm watching a segment with a guy, an interview backstage, all of a sudden they cut to the crowd, and they show this panning shot of the crowd. Who gives a shit? Who cares? You know, Alex Greenfield, who's a former writer for WWE, head writer for SmackDown for a couple years, he did an interview on Jim Ross's podcast that's worth listening to, because he also goes off on Kevin Dunn. He is no fan of Kevin Dunn, and he talks about what a lot of people have. He's not the only one. People who have worked in that company who say that Kevin Dunn is a jealous person. He undercuts anybody who he feels threatened by, whether it's a writer, an announcer, anybody. He, according to Greenfield, hates Jim Ross, and he told JR, he said, JR, whether you know this or not, Kevin Dunn hated you, and he thinks that Kevin Dunn had a hand in ultimately JR's downfall, because he's got Vince's ear, you know, who knows what he may have said to Vince. So, not a lot of people are fond of Kevin Dunn, but he made an interesting comment that I thought was actually very, very sound, and that is, when he became the head writer of SmackDown, and I don't know how much influence this guy thought he had, but he said that he tried to get somebody else, somebody different, to run the production side of the SmackDown brand, because his goal was for SmackDown to be as different from Raw as possible. That, to me, was one of the reasons the whole brand split was an epic fail. And for years I said, just end the brand split, end the brand split. And finally they did. It was a farce anyway for so many years. Even when they finally canned it, the brand split had really been dead for years. And people still will send me questions on occasion. Well, do you think they should bring back the brand split? Things are so boring now. Things are so bad. It's the same guys over and over. Bring back the brand split. No, they shouldn't bring back the brand split because these people are incapable of doing it the right way. If I knew they would do it the right way, I might endorse the idea, but they can't. And they won't. So I don't want to see a brand split. That's just going to make things worse. With the lack of depth that they have right now, you're going to divide the rosters? That would be a terrible move. And I think his point is accurate. If there was a way to somehow make SmackDown look and feel completely different from Raw, I'm not just talking the roster. I'm talking the way the show looks. The intro, when it goes on the air, the look and feel of the whole thing. That would be fantastic. I think that's what Paul Heyman was kind of hoping they were going for when they relaunched ECW on Sci-Fi back in 06. It was going to be a more grungy, gritty, old-school version of ECW that wouldn't look low-rent per se, but it would definitely have a less polished look to it. And they chickened out, and they didn't do it. And what happened? ECW ended up looking like every other fucking show that they have, and it failed. Because it was no different. It was like what today would be Main Event. That's what it was. Or in some ways, NXT, because you had some of the newer faces they would throw on there. CM Punk made his main roster debut as part of the ECW brand. I believe Jack Swagger did as well. So maybe it was like a hybrid mix of Main Event and NXT. But there was nothing about the show that differentiated it from Raw or SmackDown, except the roster. So I think Greenfield made a very good point there, and it would have been very interesting to get somebody else in there and say, listen, let Dunn handle Raw, and we'll have this guy, this production guru from the NBA that we're going to hire, and let him run SmackDown. And the whole show will just look and feel different. And obviously that never happened. And that probably is why Kevin Dunn was not fond of Mr. Greenfield. But I do think there is something to be said when it comes to Kevin Dunn and his vision of what the WWE product is. He has his little go-to devices, whether it's a certain camera shot, or remember when the Shield would come out and the shaky cam just drove me nuts. It was like, oh God, just please hold the fucking camera still, please. Oh, no, we got to shake the camera up to make it look like it's just pandemonium and chaos. And, like, part of the reason the show is so stale, there's a lot of reasons why the WWE product feels stale. Part of that is that everything looks the same. The Raw set. They invested all those millions of dollars to have their little HD set that can transform into, you know, to put whatever logo, whatever they want on that screen by the entranceway. But when you look at Raw, in the 1990s, and you look at Raw in the 2000s, and you look at Raw today, the radical change in the way that Raw looked from just 93 to 97, and then compare the way Raw has looked pretty much since the Attitude Era to the way it looks today. It's the same set. It's the big Titantron. It's the ramp, although the ramp now isn't really much of a ramp. I mean, the ramp used to be much higher, but it's the same damn set. Everything pretty much looks the same. The graphics and stuff may change, the music may change, but the basic look of the show is the same. There's been no radical transformation. If you the last time you watched Raw was 98, and you tuned into Raw now, you'd probably look at it and say, okay, now it's in HD, so there's more colors, but it basically looks the same. So there's a lot of different things about the show that are the same. Nothing really changes. Maybe it would with somebody else in that position, a different vision of what the show should look like, I think would really freshen things up quite a bit. I think it would freshen things up a lot. Wouldn't change the creative. That's not going to make the creative suddenly get good. But I think that has a lot to do with the staleness of the product. I really do. And as long as that guy is at the helm and he's in power, and I imagine he will be as long as Vince is around, then this is the way it's going to be. And I'm sure when that day comes that Vince is no longer around and Triple H and Stephanie take over, one of the first things they do is probably going to get somebody new in that catbird seat running the show from the production end, and I think that they'll be better off for it. So we had our weekly DQ finish off of Kane's interference in the main event. John Cena beat Ryback, Kane ran in. Ryback had the match won, you know, he was doing quite well, and Kane just couldn't help himself. He's like, must not interfere, but he couldn't stop himself, and then he interfered. And so this pissed off Ryback, and what ended up happening was it broke down into a big brawl with all the authority guys in there. All hell kind of broke loose, and Sheamus came out, and Big Show came out, and he knocked out Jamie Noble and Joey Mercury, but he got attacked as well. Eventually, Ryback came back. He had been knocked out. He came back and cleaned house, and he walked out. He didn't stand united with Team Cena, but in the end, I'm sure Ryback will end up on Team Cena. So the way the teams seem to be shaping up for Survivor Series, it'll be Cena, Ziggler, Big Show, Sheamus, and Ryback against Rollins, Kane. We have Mark Henry, Rusev, and, let's go to the last segment of the show, because they show Triple H and Stephanie watching all of this mayhem on the monitor. All of a sudden, Dolph Ziggler gets thrown in into camera view, and he's laying on the floor like he's dead, and they pan up, and we see Luke Harper. And Luke Harper looks at the authority and says, I'm a team player. And that's how they go off the air. So based on that tease, it would certainly appear that Luke Harper is getting the last spot in that match, which means that the poster that leaked, which pretty much I think had the teams set in this configuration, only it had Cesaro on Team Authority, apparently it's going to be Harper. So on the one hand, it just makes you shake your head about Cesaro again, because now here he is, a man with no match. I defy anybody to tell me that something happened or he didn't say something that pissed somebody off and got him in the doghouse, because I can't explain this for the life of me, what they've been doing with this fucking guy. But I can't hate on the move, because Luke Harper is really good, and this could really be a big opportunity for him. And I hope it is. I hope he lasts a little while in that Survivor Series match before he, I'm sure, gets eliminated. And this could be a real breakout performance for him. Of the three, you know, Bray, I still think Bray will end up being a big star down the road, probably one of the biggest they have, probably as a babyface. Rowan, I don't see going anywhere at all. He's a comedy goof right now. He came out during a match on this show looking for Renee Young, so they're doing like a stalker angle with him and her. That's great. That's a great mid-card feud, but it ain't, you know, he ain't going to get higher than that level on his own. It's just not going to happen. But Harper absolutely can get higher than that on his own. And I think he has the potential to be a main event player at some point as that character evolves. And this could be a big opportunity for him. So I'm fine with him being in the match. It's just, you know, it's just a shame they can't find more for Cesaro. I feel like he should be on that same level right now. And that was Raw. That was Raw from the UK. They made the announcement that this Monday night, on the go-home episode to build up the Survivor Series, the special guest celebrity host of Monday Night Raw will be Grumpy Cat. Grumpy Cat is being brought to Raw. because Grumpy Cat has a Lifetime television movie debuting, I believe, this week. Maybe not this week. I think it's like a Christmas-themed movie, so maybe it's debuting in a few weeks. I don't care, so I'm not going to look it up. But he's got a fucking movie, or she has a fucking movie coming out. So they're going to have the cat on the show. Now, here's my thought on the cat. I'm a cat person, okay? You have the shirt in our store. I'm a sound-off guy, right? I'm a cat guy, which doesn't mean I'm not a dog person. I don't hate dogs. I've just, you know, as I grew up when I was younger up to today, I've had cats, and they're a lot easier to maintain, and you don't have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go walk them and pick up their shit. You have a box that sits in the corner. You're like, that's where you go, and they go in the box, and they shit, and it's a lot easier to clean up. Cats are just generally easier to maintain. They're more independent. Are they as fun? They can be, but they could also just kind of look at you and not really give two shits about you. That's kind of what I like about cats. There's a certain charm to it. Unfortunately, I'm allergic to cats and dogs, which you might be asking, if you're allergic to cats, why do you have one? It's a long, convoluted story. I'm more bothered by the exploitation of this frickin' cat. And you know what? Good on the owners if they could turn this into a thing that makes them hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. They've capitalized on it. I don't know that I wouldn't have done the same, but I think at this point, Grumpy Cat is played out. I feel bad for the cat. If they're going to have the cat on this show, I don't know if they're going to bring the cat out in front of the crowd. They may just do a backstage comedy bit with the cat. It may be a quick one-and-done type of thing like what they did with Chrisley, okay? And they had Chrisley in the front row, and they did an interview with him, and it was quick, it was painless, it was pointless, but it was painless, and they moved on. Maybe they'll do the same thing with Grumpy Cat. I am not going to sit here and rant and rave about Grumpy Cat being on Raw, because what do you people expect? How many fucking celebrity bullshit hosts have this show had? Al fucking Sharpton. They had the Reverend Al Sharpton on this show. One of the worst god-awful celebrity appearances I've ever seen in my frickin' life. Chris Jericho, by the way, said the same thing in his book. He ranks the best and worst guest host in the history of Raw in one chapter. And the worst, by far, according to him, in terms of just how it played out on TV and just working with the person, Al Sharpton, by far. I can rank a whole bunch of other shitty Raw celebrity hosts that they've had. There are plenty of human beings that have been on the show that will end up being far worse hosts than Grumpy Cat will be. I'm more, you know, kind of like, really, you're going to trot the cat out there? I hope they don't bring the cat out in front of the crowd. That cat will probably be just terrified. And look, it's a cat. I know it's a meme and everything else, and it's kind of funny, haha, but, you know, the cat has a form of dwarfism. That's why it looks the way it does. And at this point, it's like, all right. You know, it was funny at first. Now it just kind of feels exploitative. And a fucking Christmas movie on Lifetime. Really? Is this what it's come to now? Grumpy Cat gets a fucking Lifetime movie? You know what the sad part is? It'll probably end up being a better movie than most of the WWE Films movies. I'll watch Grumpy Cat over The Chaperone any day of the week. So after Raw went off the air, they had this ECW Exposed special. Trying to milk ECW week on the network. They had Joey Styles and Paul Heyman live in studio back in Stamford. And for those of you who haven't seen it, I don't know why you wouldn't check it out. The network is free. I think as long as the network is free, it's well worth signing up and checking it out. I don't think it's anything outrageously good. There wasn't a ton of new ground covered, although I did learn something that I was not previously aware of. Heyman obviously is very good at telling stories, and the interplay with him and Joey Styles was fun. They have a good chemistry back and forth. So it was good for what it was. It wasn't anything groundbreaking or anything of that nature. They had the Brian Pillman segment from ECW where he wrestled a pencil, which is probably the best match I saw all night on Monday night. We had Paul Heyman talking about, he was answering questions. They took questions from Twitter. And so one of the questions was, of the current WWE roster, who on the current roster do you feel, I guess in their current incarnation, could have been a big star, could have been a big success in the old ECW? Which I thought was a good question. And Heyman's first answer was Dolph Ziggler. Actually, his first answer may have been Brock Lesnar, obviously. Brock Lesnar would have been a huge badass in the old ECW. But he said Dolph Ziggler would have been a massive star in ECW. And I agree. I can totally see Dolph Ziggler as a heel. not so much as a babyface, getting over huge and being well respected for his work. I think that really is above all else what would have gotten him over with the audience in the old ECW is his bumping and just his overall work and sacrifice. And God knows how he would have just, you know, beaten his body to shit for that promotion back in the day. I mean, he beats his body to hell now. Back then, there were no rules. I can only imagine what he would have been doing in matches back then. He'd be in a wheelchair by now. But I thought that was very interesting that beyond Brock, the number one guy that came to mind, according to Heyman, as far as him being a big success at ECW, would have been Dolph Ziggler. Heyman also said that John Cena would have been huge in the old ECW. And his rationale was that Cena, his tenure on top, has exceeded all of the biggest stars in the history of the business. Austin, 4 years. Brock, you know, 6 years, let's say. Maybe not even. And even Hogan, you know, 9 years, 10 years on top during his original WWE run. No one else's run comes close to the kind of run that John Cena has had. Now, we can debate that question. That could be a whole question, a whole topic for a different mailbag one day as far as what goes into each of those runs. And it's one thing to say that John Cena has been on top for 10 years or 12 years, you know, but is that as impressive when you really look at the overall state of WWE? We can get into that. But that was part of Heyman's rationale, okay? These top stars only had a few years on top. Cena's had 10. And the work ethic part. Now, I'm going to say something that you may disagree with, and that I agree with Paul Heyman, that John Cena could have been a huge star, and would have been a huge star, in the original ECW. I don't think he's wrong, at all, in making that comment. And I'll explain why. If we're talking about the current John Cena, transplanted into the old ECW, which I think is what the question was, then I think John Cena in the old ECW would have been a gold mine. And even if we're talking about a younger John Cena, first coming up in the business, only coming up at ECW instead, you know, look, if your logic is that John Cena is a shitty wrestler, and so therefore how could you possibly say that John Cena would have been a huge fit or a huge success or a gold mine in the old ECW? Guess what? ECW was filled with shitty wrestlers with far less charisma than John Cena has. There were a ton of shitty wrestlers in the old ECW. And Paul Heyman was the master in taking whatever it was that they had, the Sandman, for example. Sandman is not a good wrestler. But the Sandman had something with that character, and he was beer drinking long before Stone Cold was ever beer drinking on television, and he built this massive fan following in ECW and became one of their biggest stars. Okay, and we can go through some of the Dudleys over the year. I mean, again, we can go through the old ECW roster and pick out the guys, and it's a subjective thing, of course, but okay, this guy is a good wrestler. This guy's a great wrestler. This guy sucks, but he's funny. And so Heyman focused on that, and he got over. Or, hey, this guy, you know, look at Taz. Now, Taz was a good wrestler, but Taz was built up as this big-time badass at ECW. Taz was like 5'7". Pissed off at the world. And is he a badass? I don't know, 5'7"? Hey, in the land of the giants back in the day, he would have been eaten alive. But in ECW, despite how small he was, Heyman was able to convince people that, hey, this is not a guy you want to fuck with. Because he can hurt you. He can hurt you bad. And that was his aura. Now, when he went to WWE, he wasn't so much of a badass anymore. I would have tried to keep it going, but you couldn't... You couldn't build Taz in WWE back then the way that Paul Heyman booked him in ECW. You had to change it in some way. Obviously, they changed it a little too much, and the guy became nothing special. You could have tried to keep that special aura about him, but at some point, you know, he becomes exposed because now he's not in there with guys like Sabu and Chris Candido, who are his size or maybe just slightly bigger than him, maybe. Okay, they weren't, like, so much bigger than him. But now he's in a company with guys like The Undertaker and Kane and The Rock, who was a big dude, okay? And so he was going to be exposed no matter what. My point is this. John Cena, if the current character was put back in that old ECW, would have been one of the biggest stars in wrestling still, just in a different company, because people would hate him so much. And imagine in the old ECW arena environment, there literally would have been riots. And it would have been awesome having a guy like that on the roster that you can take a Taz or a Tommy Dreamer or a Rob Van Dam and put them in there against Cena, because Cena is just everything ECW is not supposed to be. And you can make so much money off this guy because people would want to see him killed. They would want to see him die in the middle of the ring. That's how passionate they would be to want to see Cena get his ass kicked. Now, Cena would have to not necessarily turn heel, but again, just maybe play it up a little bit because he's smart enough to do that. But I visualize this and I'm like, yeah, of course he would have been. He would have been a gold mine in the old ECW. And I don't want to hear the argument about what kind of a worker he is. Because again, that's not a valid argument. There were far shittier wrestlers in ECW than John Cena. And I wouldn't even call John Cena a shitty wrestler, because that's not fair. He's not a great wrestler, but he's not shitty. There were guys in ECW who were the drizzling shits, and they still got over. So I don't understand why it's such a big leap in logic for people to hear Paul Heyman say that and be like, oh, what a blasphemous thing for him to say. John Cena is the furthest thing from the old ECW. Those people don't get it. They don't get it. And Paul Heyman back then, if he knew this guy existed now, he would have did everything in his power to get him on his roster. I guarantee you. Heyman also said that ECW's biggest flaw was the lack of an ad sales team. Hopefully Dixie Carter is paying attention to this. He said that he was never on WWE payroll. He never took 1 cent from them while running ECW. He goes into more detail about this on his documentary, as far as that goes, and the stuff with Too Cold Scorpio and Tommy Boy Records and all that kind of stuff. The one thing he talked about here that he, I don't believe, has ever shared before, so I certainly never heard of it. He talked about Shane Douglas pitching the idea to Paul about seeing if the WWE would agree to let Brian Pillman wrestle him at the November to Remember pay-per-view. This would have been in 1997, when Pillman was already well into his WWE run, and he had gone through some more surgeries on his ankle. Because I believe one of the original plans, when Heyman was originally working with Pillman, and he was in ECW before he signed with WWE, they were hoping to build to a Pillman-Shane Douglas match, I think back in 96, and it just never happened, and Pillman was probably still hurt. But I guess Douglas pitched the idea to Heyman again in 97 about doing the match, and Heyman told Shane Douglas that Pillman would not be alive in November for the match. And this was in August, according to Paul. And he said that he's never told that part of the story, or that story, on the air before. And sure enough, Pillman died in October. So Paul seemed to have an inkling that he was going through some rough times and wasn't even going to be around for that pay-per-view in November, which is pretty startling stuff. And, you know, every time I think about Brian Pillman, and it really hit me watching the footage of him wrestling the pencil and the stuff in the kitchen, spitting in the food, and everything he did in ECW, and with that whole loose cannon gimmick, even the stuff he did with Austin in WWE, you know, goddamn, and that guy would have been huge. He would have been a huge part of the Attitude Era. And I don't think he would have been, like, the top guy world champion. I'm not even saying that. I think he could have gotten a world title run, absolutely, once Austin became the big star in 98. And I think you could have gone back to the whole Austin Pillman thing after Michaels went away. And Pillman could have gotten a short run with the belt. I think, absolutely, whether it was one of those one-day Kane runs with the title, where maybe Pillman gets a win over Austin on a pay-per-view and loses it back to him the next night, or he loses it back at the next pay-per-view. I don't think Heyman, or Pillman, I should say, would have been champion for very long, but I think you could have absolutely, one of the first programs you do with Steve Austin, the way I look at it, if you have a healthy Brian Pillman under contract, as much as I love the stuff they did with Austin and Dude Love, and that second Austin Dude Love match in May of 98 is one of the greatest matches that I've ever seen, from the perspective of it had everything that made that whole era of wrestling so much fun. The wrestling itself wasn't very good. It was more of a brawl. But just everything about that match, you know, they love to say, oh, we're sports entertainment. That, to me, is like the quintessential sports entertainment WWE match blueprint. Like, everything about that match was so much fun. But as much as I love that match, if it were me and I had a healthy Pillman, I don't see how you don't do Austin's first program coming out of WrestleMania 14 with Brian Pillman. You could have easily gotten a couple of pay-per-view matches and stretched it out over several months, and it would have been so awesome. Imagine a healthy Brian Pillman doing his thing with that gimmick in the Attitude Era, feuding with Austin. You know, the former Hollywood Blondes wrestling for the championship in that period with what they were allowed to get away with? Are you kidding me? Oh, my God. It's just, it's too bad. It really is. It's too bad things turned out the way they did with Pillman. Also, they mentioned on the ECW special that starting on Friday, this would have been this past Friday, so it should be on demand right now as I speak on the WWE Network, I just haven't bothered to check, is the Rise and Fall of ECW documentary that was released many, many years ago. In fact, the documentary sold so well on DVD that that is what convinced Vince McMahon and WWE to move ahead with the ECW One Night Stand reunion show in 2005 at the behest of Rob Van Dam. They saw that there was still an audience, people were still willing to pay money, and so they said, let's bring back ECW for one night only, which turned into another one night only, which turned into a whole brand relaunch that did not turn out too well. But if you've never seen the documentary before, then you really owe it to yourself to check it out. In my opinion, it still is one of the, if not the best DVD documentary that WWE has ever produced. And they have made some good ones since then. The CM Punk one, the Warrior one, after he died, that they put out earlier this year. That, to me, is probably still my number one. I mean, the way they turned that thing around and the footage they had in there that had never been seen before and knowing what ended up happening to the Warrior right after, I mean, that is just, to me, that probably is still the best 1 hour of television they've ever produced. But this is way up there. And if you've never seen it, you can check it out right now on the network. Again, the network is free, so you may as well just sign up for it and watch The Rise and Fall because it's very well done. One thing before we move on here, because we're really going over time here, but I posed this question on Twitter. It was just a simple, innocent question during Raw on Monday night. I had read an item online. There were a lot of reports coming out of the recent meeting that Rey Mysterio had with WWE and Vince McMahon, because Rey wants out. He wants out. His contract, as far as he's concerned, expired. They said no. Because of all the time he missed with injuries, Vince McMahon rolled the contract over, so now I think it expires in April of next year. It sounds like they may have reached some common ground and that Rey may possibly be coming back to WWE television soon. I guess we'll find out. But there's a lot of acrimony between the two sides right now. And if it were up to Rey, he'd be gone. He'd split, and he'd go to AAA or Lucha Underground or wherever he's ultimately going to end up. And I posed the question, I said, do the fans that are upset with CM Punk for deserting his fans feel the same way about Rey Mysterio? He doesn't want to come back either. If he had his way, he'd be gone. There'd be no final send-off, thank you fans, he'd be gone. And so I said, you know, do you feel the same way, or do you view it as two totally different situations? And there's a lot of feedback to that question. You know, one guy wrote in to me, I think he was saying how, well, they ran Rey Mysterio into the ground and, you know, he paid the price with his body and it's very unfair for them to do what they've done to him and not let him go and give him his release. And other people wrote in and said that Rey has been a joke for years. He's made of glass. You know, the difference is that Punk was still in his prime. He had loads to do. That doesn't have anything to do with the question, though. It doesn't matter how many more years in his prime you think CM Punk had. At the end of the day, CM Punk has fans, and Rey Mysterio still has fans. Especially a lot of younger fans. Probably more younger fans than Punk does. And Punk left, has refused to come back, has refused to even address the fans about this in any sort of social media forum. He has just disappeared. And he's doing his own thing, and he's left wrestling behind. No goodbyes, no nothing. And, you know, Rey, to some extent, if he had his way, it looks like would have done the same thing. I mean, I don't know that he would have stayed silent, but he didn't want the big send-off and to say anything to the fans. He just wanted to leave. So how are the two situations different? I just think it's an interesting question. And a lot of people have a lot of very passionate things to say about Punk, whether you like the guy, you hate the guy, and the way he left. I just pose the question to all of you. How do you see those two situations? Are they the same thing? Is it hypocritical for people to feel one way about Punk and a different way about Rey? Or am I missing something here? Are they two completely different scenarios and you can't compare them at all? I'd be curious to get your feedback on that. Sounds like William Regal may be done as an in-ring performer. There was a report from one of his one-man shows that he does. He's kind of takes them on tour. And he made mention of the fact that he recently got a 3-level cervical fusion of his neck. And usually, you know, when guys went and got their necks fused, which a lot of guys did, like Austin and, you know, Lita and people like that, Rhino, Benoit, they usually do less than 3 levels together because apparently 3 levels is a career ender. That means you're done. And according to him, he got a 3-level fusion. It's not like he's been wrestling a lot recently. He'll wrestle from time to time. But the belief is that that means his in-ring career is over. We haven't heard that from Regal. Who's to say? But if that's the case, it'd kind of be a shame for them not to mention it or make a slightly bigger deal about it because, I don't know, to me, I think that's a big deal. I like William Regal. I think he's one of the more underrated performers in wrestling in the last 10, 12 years. I wouldn't put him at the top of my list, but certainly he, I don't think, gets enough credit from, let's say, the mainstream audience. A lot of the hardcore, diehard wrestling fans, they know about him and they're big fans of his. But I think he deserves more credit than that. I mean, he is a throwback to a bygone era. They don't make him like William Regal anymore. I mean, here's a guy who literally grew up wrestling at carnivals. I mean, he goes back to the carny days. I mean, find me guys these days who can say that when they came up in wrestling, they were wrestling in carnivals and shoots and half shoots with rounds and stuff like that. And Regal, not only did his hair get better over time, I don't know how that happened, but I think as a performer he got better over time. And not just in the ring either. I just feel like as a personality, back when he was the Raw GM, for example, and he would turn the lights out if the fans weren't respecting him. You know, he was on a real good run there. I think the closest he ever came realistically in WWE to being a world champion was around 2008 during that period when he was the Raw GM and he was on fire as a heel. You could have gotten away with putting the title on him. I don't remember what title it would have been, whether it was the world title or the WWE title, probably the world title. Especially back then, they had 2 world titles. You know, Regal never should have been the centerpiece focal point of the company, but you could have easily made the argument back then that, you know what, this guy deserves a run, however brief it may be, with the world heavyweight title. Let's put the belt on him. He was getting so much heat, and he was so awesome. And in the end, you know, he could have put over whoever the new guy was at the time that they were pushing on that roster. But he went, he done gone, fucked things up for himself. He's got nobody to blame but himself. He got popped for another wellness violation, not his first. And so, unfortunately, they never really trusted him again after that. But if that is the end of his career, I think we should all appreciate the performer that William Regal was. The last match that he had, the last match I saw, probably would have been the match with Cesaro, which I think was earlier this year on NXT. Him and Cesaro had a real kind of old school kind of match. It was mostly Cesaro kicking his ass. Regal didn't get a whole lot of offense in, but they were telling a story. It was really well done. Maybe it goes back to the end of last year. I really can't remember. Now he is the general manager on NXT, which that might account for why they took him off commentary, because if he had major neck surgery, that would require some downtime. And I don't know what the time frame on this would be, but it might coincide with that switch they made when they moved him into the GM slot, so that might make sense. I thought that this week's NXT was probably the best hour of NXT television all year, aside from the quarterly specials. There was not a bad match on the entire show. You had good wrestling, good storyline advancement. I mean, that's all you can ask for. Finn Balor's in-ring debut was in the opening segment. He came out for an interview, was cut off by the team of Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel, who came out to cut a promo on him. That's when Hideo Itami came out, then it turned into a tag team match. As made by Regal, who didn't even have to come out. He sent one of his assistants to announce that he was setting up a tag team match. So it was Finn Balor's in-ring debut with Itami against Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel. Balor is shredded. He looks like he's made out of granite. He already looks like a star, and he hasn't even busted out the body paint yet. Dude's going to be huge. He pinged Justin Gabriel with a vicious-looking double foot stomp off the top rope. Itami, you know, Kenta, whatever, has yet to really stand out in the ring. I think he will in time. And to the people who never saw any of his indie work, and are just going based on what they've seen of him so far in NXT, just know that two or three different guys, top WWE guys, have lifted moves from this guy. They've stolen moves from him. So trust me, he could do a lot more than just kicks. It's just a matter of adjusting to the style and them allowing him to expand his moveset. Because you never know what they're telling him to not do, do this, stay away from that. I feel like if they do that, they got to take the handcuffs off a little bit. And in due time, we'll get to see the kind of performer he really can be. Sasha Banks, with Becky Lynch in her corner, beat Alexa Bliss. Best Alexa Bliss match I've ever seen, I have to say. Sara Del Rey has got to be one of the unsung heroes in WWE right now. The work she's doing with these women, it shows, man. It shows in their work. And I don't think she gets enough credit for that. And so should Alexa. She's obviously worked hard to up her game, so she deserves as much credit as anything. Her nose got bloodied up during the match. I didn't really catch when it happened, but she was bleeding, and that elicited an ECW chant from the crowd, which I thought was mildly entertaining. Alexa even busted out a sunset flip powerbomb out of the corner at one point that looked awesome. Somebody wrote into me and said, see, like you say that Cesaro, she used the uppercut as his finish, or Tyler Breeze, she used the super kick as his. Alexa Bliss should use the sunset flip powerbomb as hers, and I'd be okay with that. It looked spectacular coming from her. I did not expect her to bust out that move. In the ring, Sasha finished her off with the backcracker into the crossface submission that she calls the bank statement. Sasha was on fire here, too. I mean, she has progressed incredibly from the first time I saw her to where she is now. She challenged Charlotte to a match for the NXT Women's title after the bout was over, which I presume takes place at the next TakeOver special, or whatever they end up calling it. NXT Tag Team Champions Sin Cara and Kalisto beat Wesley Blake and Buddy Murphy. Sin Cara won with a senton on Murphy, got the pin. Kalisto did a sick twisting corkscrew dive over the ropes onto, I want to say Wesley Blake, but don't hold me to that. That was right before the finish. That was right before the senton from Sin Cara. Otherwise, it was just a good, solid match. And I like what I've been seeing from Blake and Murphy. You know, they've got some chemistry. Hopefully they continue to build on it. They leave these guys alone because they need more teams. And they need, you know, they can be a real solid addition, I think, to that division. Like Jason Jordan and Ty Dillinger, who I'm not even sure if they're together anymore. I think they are. But I know they were trying out Dillinger with a new singles gimmick at the house shows. Just keep the two of them together and build up your tag team division. You know, Ty Dillinger is a really good wrestler. I think even Kevin Steen tweeted something about him the other night. Like, he's great. But there's nothing spectacular about the guy. And right now, you've got guys like Devitt and Steen, not to mention Zayn and Neville and everybody else. And he's better off as part of a tag team, or else he's going to get lost in the shuffle. There's nothing spectacular about him individually that will make him stand out from those awesome guys that they now have on that roster. He's better off being part of a team. The main event was Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville for the NXT Championship. What a freaking great match. I am totally digging Neville's condescending heel character who's not really a heel yet, only he kind of is. Sami is Sami. What more is there to say? I mean, he's the best babyface on the planet right now. And when he wins the title next month, and I have no doubt in my mind he's winning that championship, my only regret is that I won't be in the building that night to be part of it. I was at WrestleMania this year when Daniel Bryan won the title, and I liken it to that. I think this is similar in that he's the ultimate underdog who's been told he can't win the big one, or in the case of Daniel Bryan, you're a B-plus player, and the people. In the case of Bryan, the people are as responsible as anyone for him getting that push and ending up with that title in that main event. Okay, I still don't buy that was all part of the plan all along. Bullshit. But it's a similar thing, right? And in this case, the fans are 100% behind Sami Zayn. They're going to be euphoric when he finally pulls off that big win. But on this night, when the match was over, you know, the camera cut to Sami Zayn's face. He kind of sits up, and the look on his face, oh my God. I mean, so they have this awesome match. You should watch it, by the way. People hanging on to every near fall. Neville missed the red arrow at one point, which I don't think I've seen from him since he won the title. I don't remember there being a match since he became the champion where he did the red arrow and missed. He always hits it. And so that made for a tremendous near fall. You know, I never thought Sammy was going to win the title, but I bet a lot of people did at that point. And it played into the finish because Neville immediately grabbed his knee. He acted as though he was hurt. The referee threw up the dreaded X symbol, looked like he may call the match off, which would have been a forfeit, and Zayn would have won the title. Instead, Zayn got close, and Neville schoolboyed him for the pin. He retained the title. Now, the way this was played up after the match was over was just fantastic, because it's not as though Neville popped up and laughed, like, ha-ha, I gotcha, like he was just faking it. He continued to sell the knee. People were, like, doctors and officials were crowded around him. He's like, oh, my knee, I can't get up. And he continued to milk it, and you weren't really sure if he was hurt or not, but you were probably, like, 90% convinced that he was full of shit, okay? Sammy just sat there with this look on his face that made you want to just put your arm around the guy and let him know everything's going to be okay. He's like, he had this suicidal, I can't believe this just happened, oh my God, he's right, I can't win the big one, what am I going to do? Like, he was incredulous. He couldn't believe what just happened. And he looked so sad. And Neville has been telling him for weeks, you can't win the big one, and here was his big chance and he blew it. Neville was right. And so meanwhile, Neville comes over on his bum leg, he puts his hand on Sammy's shoulder, like he's trying to comfort him, and tell him everything's going to be all right. Great match, everything's going to be okay. The storytelling here was just fantastic. So simple, yet so effective. You know, Neville is totally full of shit. And maybe they're saving the heel turn for the NXT special, but right now he is a hated man on that brand. I cannot wait to see what these two guys have up their sleeves for their next match. As good as this one was, you could tell, like, it never quite reached, like, the awesome level, like, all-time memorable classic level, and for good reason. I'm sure they're saving whatever they have planned for that match live on the network next month. I just can't wait, and I know somebody else who can't wait either. If you doubt the power of good wrestling and good stories to draw in new fans, I have a friend who knows nothing about NXT. Probably thinks Sami Zayn is Billy Zane's less famous third cousin. Definitely knows nothing about what an indie darling the guy used to be. And I told him, I said, dude, you have to see this match. And people will write into the podcast. You guys will sometimes write in. I have my girlfriend. I have a friend. What match would you recommend to get them into wrestling? I want to recommend one really good match. And I have to kind of think about it because obviously I've seen plenty of great matches. And, you know, Shawn Michaels and Undertaker, WrestleMania 25 is probably the best WrestleMania match of all time. It's one of my all-time favorites. But that match told a story with the back and forth and the finishers that could be lost on a newer fan. So I told him, I said, you have to see this match. I always tell him about NXT, but I said, this week, you need to start with this episode. I said, the network is free, sign up, and watch this match. So he did, and as I expected, he was hooked. He said it was a better match than he's seen on Raw all year, because he thinks Raw is just the drizzling shits and gave up on it weeks ago, as many people did. But he was hooked, and he claims that he's going to keep his network subscription beyond this month. He'll pay the $9.99 for the special next month. You hear that, WWE? I've converted a new subscriber for you. I know you can use all the ones you can get, so you're welcome. But even somebody like that, you know, just a common everyday fan who doesn't follow all the different shows and doesn't know all the different people and doesn't know of the developmental stuff, watched that one match and came away from it blown away, like he rediscovered his love for wrestling. So my hat's off to Zayn and Neville. I just thought they did a fantastic job this week. ProWrestlingTees.com is the new home for Sound Off shirts and apparel. Get your official Solid Monster Sounds Off logo t-shirt and other assorted designs like the new Eat, Sleep, Sound Off, Repeat shirt, which sounds an awful lot like a typical week for me. And I know it is for some of you guys as well. Now you can show your support for the podcast wherever you go by buying a shirt. Hell, buy two of them. Pro Wrestling Tees accepts PayPal as payment and ships internationally all over the world. The more shirts we sell, the more designs we'll be able to offer in the future, but we can only do that with your help. Be one of the first 25 people to buy a shirt, and you'll get a shout-out right here on the Sound Off. Visit ProWrestlingTees.com/SolidMonsterSoundsOff to go directly to our new store. That's ProWrestlingTees.com/SolidMonsterSoundsOff. Bully Ray posted a pretty cryptic tweet. That was obviously a not-so-veiled shot at TNA during the week. He said, when generals do not properly communicate with their soldiers, consider the war lost and the soldiers dead. And this is in light of reports that TNA has kept its talent largely in the dark on a new television deal. Apparently a lot of wrestlers in TNA not very happy at the silence from management. They just don't know what the hell is going on, and that affects their future going forward. A lot of people very worried, and so it was an interesting comment for Bully to make, and one that I can totally understand. TNA has seemingly done a piss-poor job of communicating with their own talent, and really should probably keep them up to speed on what's going on. They haven't really said much of anything about a new TV deal, although it seems one, finally, after all of these months, is imminent, and there's actually a very good chance we may hear something from them later this week about it. According to PW Insider, TNA is finally expected to announce a new TV deal this week. They do have a hold on the Manhattan Center for shows on January 6th, 7th, and 8th. And also, and this is very interesting, this week's episode of TNA Impact on November 19th will be the final episode of Impact that ever airs on Spike TV. The highlight shows that they had originally planned to air next month, the clip shows, will apparently, according to PW Insider, not be airing. So that means that if they do find a new TV home, TNA will be completely dark, completely off television altogether between now and, I presume, the beginning of January. So this week's episode of Impact, it's no longer just the first, or I should say the last first-run episode. This will be it. It sounds like this Wednesday is the final ever Impact airing on Spike TV. And as far as a new TV deal is concerned, it sounds like TNA is going to be ending up on the Destination America network. And you might be asking yourself, what the hell is Destination America? Good question. I didn't know either. But apparently it's part of the Discovery Network family of channels. I didn't even know that I have it. Apparently I do. I have it, I think it's channel 162 or something here on Cablevision in the New York area. So I have the network. A lot of people probably will not. I know it's channel 286 on DirecTV, channel 194 on Dish. For those of you that have either of those services, you might want to just check that out and confirm that. The network is available in about 60 million homes, which I think translates, I had read, into just over 50% of the country. So a little more than half of the country has access to the network, and in turn would have access to Impact if Impact makes it official this week and we find out that that's where they're going. And we'll find out very soon. I wonder if we may not find out until Thursday or Friday. Just let that last episode of Impact air, and then they'll come out with the announcement. Maybe they'll announce something Monday morning. I don't know. But it definitely sounds like Destination America is the likely destination for Impact going forward. And, you know, one of our listeners, Max, actually sent in a question for the mailbag, but it's worth bringing up now. And he asked me, he goes, what would it take for Ring of Honor to pass TNA? Ring of Honor is in about 38% of homes nationwide, according to Max, while TNA's rumored new deal will put them in just over 45% of homes on premium cable. Again, I'm not sure if that's accurate. That could be a little bit higher than that. But he says TNA has basically regressed into an indie promotion with television. They both have wrestlers signed to per-appearance deals. They both are on a limited number of pay-per-views or pay-per-view dates, which also leads to the question, would TNA gain anything from doing iPay-per-views? To answer the last question first, not much. TNA doing iPay-per-views changes nothing for the company. But I thought the statement that Max made about how TNA has basically regressed into an indie promotion with TV is so true. It is so true. And they're doing what they can to stay alive. It sounds like they're going to end up on this second-rate network. I doubt very seriously whatever money they were pulling from Spike is going to be the kind of money they're pulling from Destination America, which begs the question, what does that mean for the future of TNA? You know, it's great that they'll find a TV home. At what point can we really start to get excited, though, that things are going to change, that they've turned a corner, that they're going to start to really sign some new talent and, or maybe get back on the road? I mean, who knows? At what point do things start to change for the better? I don't think that this really will change anything. If anything, it sounds like if they're not going to get the kind of money they were getting before, there may be even more cuts. How much more can they possibly cut? So I still think there's some very big question marks when it comes to TNA's future, but if they can sign this deal, or if it's already a done deal, good for them. Because I don't want to see TNA go away completely. I would like to see TNA thrive, and I'm pretty sure I've said this before. I don't think TNA thrives unless there's new ownership involved. I don't see how anybody could expect, after 12 years with the same people in charge, I don't see how people can suddenly think, with all the troubles they're having, well, now things are going to be different. Now things are going to turn around. They're going to turn the corner. I don't think anything really changes. If they stay on TV, great. That's step number one. Step number two has to be change. Step number two has to be some positive things happening for this company to get that product buzzing and exciting again. And I see nothing on the horizon that really changes that for TNA. And getting on this network, it's not ideal. Like I said, there's going to be plenty of people who don't have the network. There's going to be people who have it and don't even know that they have it. And they're not going to grow their audience, and I think that's the key here. I think the key is that if they're pulling about 900,000 to a million viewers each week, and when Impact went from Thursdays to Wednesdays, they lost a lot of audience. They gained back most of it, but not all of it. So I say a million. I don't even remember the last time TNA did a million. It may have been a couple of weeks ago. I honestly just don't remember. I've seen figures like 800,000, 900,000 thrown around. Their audience week to week has already gone down because of the switchover. If they end up on Destination America with the audience and exposure that they have, there is no way that TNA is pulling a million people every week anymore. There is no way that TNA is pulling 900,000 viewers a week. What that number is going to be, I don't know. You could be looking at a number as low as 400,000 or 500,000, even 6. So it's great that they may be on the precipice here of signing a new television deal to keep them alive, to keep them from going under, at least stalling maybe what may be the inevitable. But they're just going to lose more audience, and I think that's the opposite direction that you want to be going in here. And their hands are tied. It's not like TNA, I'm sure, would reject a great deal from TBS or FX. There's nobody interested. So they kind of are out of options here. But I just think it just doesn't bode well for the future of TNA when they're probably going to accept a deal that's not as lucrative as the other one. And even with that deal, they were already making severe cuts. And now their audience, which has already gone down a little bit, is going to go down even more. So what that means for their future, I don't know. But after all these months of waiting and all these months of hearing that they keep telling people, well, we're gonna have something to announce. They were telling wrestlers in a week. And a week would go by and a week would go by and nothing would happen. So you can understand why the wrestlers would be very frustrated. It sounds like this might finally be the week where we hear some news. It has to be. If this is the last episode of Impact on Spike, we have to hear something. So we'll know more in a few days. EC3. Suffered a torn biceps. He will likely be having surgery, and if that's the case, he will be gone for several months. It's a good thing TNA has no shows planned, I guess, between now and January. That should give him some time to heal up, but that sucks. That's a shitty injury, and EC3 is one of my favorites in TNA. He's a younger, homegrown guy in a lot of ways that WWE dropped the ball on, and TNA has actually pushed him, and they pushed him well, and I'm digging the character, and I hope he's able to come back real soon. So the next-to-last, I guess, episode ever of Impact on Spike aired this past week. I'm just going to run through some of the key things. I'm not doing a blow-by-blow of everything on this show because we're running low here and there's really no point to it. But the key stuff is that James Storm and Abyss are now the new TNA World Tag Team Champions. Abyss has joined up with James Storm's Revolution group with Matic and the great Sonata. And they beat the Wolves. Here's the thing. When I found out, because I read the taping spoilers weeks and weeks ago, so I knew that the Wolves had lost the belts, and it was like, after that series of matches with the Hardys and the Dudleys, and you put these guys over as like the second coming of tag team wrestling, these great champions, and then at the tapings you have James Storm and Abyss beat them for the belts. It was like, what sense does any of that make? Now, I take it that a lot of people lost their titles, including the Wolves, because they were not under long-term deals. I think that was really the rationale. More than any kind of great storyline idea they had for James Storm, it was, we don't know what the future holds, and so going into this last set of tapings they did, we have to put the belts on the guys that we know are locked into deals. So I think that had more to do with it than anything else. That being said, watching it play out on television, I'm still not a fan of it, but at least it did the way they did it did not offend me, you know, as a fan or anything like that. It wasn't like, oh God, you know, they had a story. They're putting over James Storm in this Revolution group. Abyss joining, you know, whatever. You know, the Abyss character is what it is at this point. He's been there forever, and we've seen him turn heel and turn face and turn heel and turn face. He's the Big Show of TNA. He's the Kane of TNA, right down to the mask. But I thought the way they handled this was actually not that bad. The Wolves got screwed over. Davey Richards, they were beating on his previously broken leg. It was kind of like a heavy injury angle almost to his leg. Got the pin on Eddie Edwards. They're the champions now. And if all works out well with TNA and they get back on a new network and they want to keep the feud going and put the belts back on the Wolves, that would be the way to go. I don't see James Storm and Abyss long-term being the tag team champions, but I thought the way they handled it was okay. We also had Samoa Joe forfeiting his X Division championship due to an injury that I believe it was a legit injury he sustained. I'm not sure if the forfeiting of the X Division title here was just pure storyline or if, in fact, he was not able to wrestle and they had no choice but to take the belt off him. Joe's another one who I think is either his deal is up or is about to be up, I believe. I could be wrong about that, which, again, may have been why they wanted to get that belt off of him. So he came out talking about an injury that he didn't really go into any specifics about it. We're not sure what the injury is or was. I remember reading it may have had something to do with his shoulder, but he vacated the X Division title, said he was going to go home and train and get better and come back and get his belt back. So there's a four-way setup for Impact this week with Low-Ki, Zema Ion, Tigre Uno, and Manic for the vacant championship, so a new champion will be determined. We also had Gunnar and Sam Shaw in what I hope was the blow-off to their feud, which actually was the best part of anything, any segment we've seen with Gunnar and Sam Shaw up to this point. This was actually a pretty good match. They had a no disqualification match. Reminded me in some ways of the no DQ match that Storm had, or Gunnar had with James Storm, although that there was blood and it was a much better brawl, but this was a brawl. You know, this was a brawl, like I said, hopefully to blow off the feud between the two of them. There was one spot where I believe Gunnar superplexed Sam Shaw onto a pile of steel chairs in the ring, which looked like it sucked for both guys. Brittany got involved. She was out there with Sam Shaw. But in the end, Gunnar was able to execute his move on Shaw, laid him out on top of the chairs, pinned him 1-2-3, so Gunnar gets the win. Pretty good. Better than I expected it to be. And the main event was Bobby Lashley and Austin Aries, which went to a double countout. They call Lashley the Destroyer, and that's exactly what he was this week. Lashley has been a man possessed ever since he lost the championship to Bobby Roode. He wants his rematch. He is entitled to his rematch. Remember, it was MVP who got the title shot. Lashley still did not get his rematch with Bobby Roode, and he just kept saying, Roode, Roode. At one point at the end of the show, he had Aries laid out on the ramp, just completely devastated Austin Aries, and he put him in the crossface. And as he has him in the crossface, he's chanting, Roode, I want Roode. So they really built him up as a monster here on this show. The match itself was pretty good. Like I said, double countout finish. And that's how they went off the air. There was no Bobby Roode on the show this week. Kurt Angle had told Lashley that he was away doing promotional stuff for TNA, which would be a first for TNA, promoting. And that was the show. So the second to last episode of Impact, it's just about over. Spike era. It's just about over, and I sure hope they've got a plan, and this new deal, whatever form it takes, works out for them, because the product is just very stagnant right now, despite the good wrestling and generally speaking, the good storytelling. It just feels like a dead product, and it's very hard. It feels like a lame duck product. Like, you know, they're about to leave the network. You don't know where they're going to end up. I mean, as much as they haven't told their own wrestlers, they haven't told the fans anything. So the fans don't know where they're going to end up. And that's an interesting one, too, because think about this, and I just thought of this. That was a big issue with WWE and Spike when they left Spike to go back to USA, and Spike did not want any mentions of USA Network on their show. I think they even tried to bleep it when they tried to promote it. Now, yeah, it's true, we live in an age of social media, everyone's on the internet, and plus Twitter and all that kind of stuff, but you've got an audience that watches Impact. Let's say 950,000 people are going to watch this week's episode of Impact. And that might be generous, but let's say it's 950. Of that 950, let's be honest, a good part of that are diehard wrestling fans who will find out on the internet where they're going to be, what network they're going to be on, what day of the week they're going to be on. I presume they're staying on Wednesdays, but I have no idea. But if they don't have anything to announce yet, and the voiceovers are already done in studio, which I'm sure they are, or if not, they'll do them tomorrow maybe with Tanae and Taz, there's got to be a mention on the show of what's going on. There's got to be a mention on the show this week of where they're going to end up. Because it's just crazy to me to think that you will have fans who don't know, who are going to watch Impact and expect it to be on the following week, and it won't be on. And they will know nothing about Destination America or whatever network Impact is going to end up on. There's got to be some kind of announcement on the air to the audience, even if it's just go to ImpactWrestling.com to learn more about where Impact is moving to. They've got to say something, right? On the show this week, you would think it would be foolish not to. Some quick thoughts on this week's episode, number 3 of Lucha Underground, which I enjoyed yet again. I'm digging the product big time so far, including the production of the backstage vignettes. I still think that continues to be, besides the wrestling, that continues to be one of the strongest points of the whole production, is the way they do it. And it takes a little getting used to, you know, because it's shot like a movie. You know, a lot of these scenes are shot like a movie, and some people think it's campy. I don't really look at it as being too campy. I actually can appreciate it. It's different than the usual backstage wrestling segment you would see on Raw or on Impact. And they actually opened the show, I think, some of the best interplays between Conan and Dario Cueto, the owner of the temple. I think Conan is just great in his role. He is so awesome. And they opened the show with him in Cueto's office, talking to him and, you know, telling him how he brought in these three guys from Mexico who were going to be wrestling in the main event. And that's actually the three-way they set up with Drago, Phoenix, and Pentagon Jr. And Cueto made a mention at one point of El Patron, and it actually went over my head at first, but one of you guys kind of mentioned to me El Patron is the name that Alberto Del Rio is going by now down in Mexico. And there's been a lot of talk, a lot of scuttlebutt that Alberto Del Rio wants to go to Lucha Underground, is all but going to be going to Lucha Underground probably the beginning of next year. I think they do their next tapings in January. My understanding is that I think Lucha Underground goes for like 39 weeks, which is a long time. Then they take a break, maybe like a little off-season, then they come back. So I don't know exactly when we'll end up seeing Del Rio on Lucha Underground, but the mention of El Patron here by Cueto, and I think Conan made mention of the fact like, oh, he has border issues, but they've been taken care of or something like that, could very well be a nod to Del Rio coming in, which would add some star power. And if Rey Mysterio eventually gets out of his contract in WWE and is able to go, he may end up in Lucha Underground too. So I like the product now, and as they add one or two more named people who could potentially bring new fans into the product and maybe make El Rey happy, you know, you always want to keep the network happy. So that could bode well for their future. They could use some big names like that. I don't want to see the product flooded with just ex-WWE guys. People mock TNA for that. I mock TNA for that. Alberto Del Rio going to Lucha Underground, given the nature of the product, kind of would make sense in a way. But we'll see. We'll see if he actually ends up there or not. But I thought that the opening match was El Mariachi Loco, who was introduced as like a local guy by Dario Cueto. Just some dude. He was in there against Masquerita Sagrada, who is a Mexican mini. So we've already seen a male versus female match on Lucha Underground. Now we had our first mini versus non-mini match, I guess you would say. It actually was pretty good for what it was. Again, you really have to suspend your disbelief when the little guy is in there doing his thing. But if you can get past that, it actually wasn't a bad match. And Sagrada got the win in the end. So poor Mariachi Loco. They recapped everything that happened the week before with Chavo Guerrero turning heel and just obliterating anything that moved, including Sexy Star with the steel chair. I said last week I was not a fan of it. I was not a fan of it more so because I just can't get into Chavo Guerrero. Chavo is not a top guy. He was never a top guy. He never will be a top guy. It doesn't mean he's a bad wrestler. It doesn't mean he's a bad guy. I just cannot take him seriously if he's going to be either the lead heel or one of the top heels in the promotion. This badass guy who's just beating everybody up with a chair. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I am not a huge fan of Chavo Guerrero. So it's a big leap for me to take this guy seriously in that role. But they did a sit-down interview, which apparently was originally done live in the building, and for whatever reason, I guess it just didn't go over very well. So they ended up doing it in the in an empty arena, basically. When the temple was empty, they had Vampiro sit down with Chavo for, which I think made for a better segment. And I said that earlier when I was talking about Bray Wyatt and his promos. I just think there are certain interviews, sit-down interviews and segments, and they did this weeks ago. They had a sit-down interview in the back. They do these Michael Cole, Triple H weekly chats on WWE.com. They did an interview in that exact style, although Bray Wyatt dismissed Michael Cole in the first 5 seconds of it, when they were building up the Bray Jericho match, either the first or the second one. And they kept the audience in the background for it. I'm pretty sure they did. Maybe they didn't. Maybe that's what I liked about it. Maybe they didn't. But it's one of those things where, like, segments like that are sometimes much better without the crowd noise in the background because it can adversely affect the story you're trying to tell. And there really is just no need for it. There really is. There's no need for every segment like that to have crowd noise or any kind of ambient noise in the background like that. So I thought, in this case, there was no crowd noise, obviously. It was just an empty arena with these two guys sitting there having a sit-down interview, and I think it made for a better segment than it would have been had they taped this in front of the people. And I actually thought this was really well done. And Chavo talked about the Guerrero name. He talked about Blue Demon Jr. and how he lives off his father's legacy. And he's there because he wants to collect Dario Cueto's money, you know, and he wants the fame and he wants another championship, although I don't know what championship he's talking about since there are no titles right now in Lucha Underground. I assume at some point there will be. And, you know, Vampiro was kind of going, he was a little prickly. He was going toe-to-toe with Chavo and, telling him he has some issues. And anyway, I just thought the way that this segment was, and even Chavo's performance, and getting all angry and talking about the Guerreros and the Guerrero legacy, I thought it was well done. I still don't buy Chavo in this position, but I thought the segment was well done. There was another segment afterwards with Chavo that was taped backstage. It's a dimly lit hallway, I guess backstage at the temple. And again, it looks just like something out of a movie. And as Chavo's walking, Conan is coming towards him with his cane. He looks like an old man now, although I don't know if he'll have the cane permanently because I think he only had it at the time he was recovering from, hip surgery. But Conan walks into the scene and he converses with Chavo. They're very friendly to each other. And he's talking about the fact, you know, after what happened last week with Chavo doing what he did, and even earlier in the show when Sagrada, the mini, won his match, Chavo came out and just pasted him in the head with a steel chair. So he's saying, listen, you know, with what you did to Sagrada and what you did to Blue Demon, there's a lot of people on the streets talking about that, and people aren't very happy, not very happy with what you're doing, and you need to make like a ghost and disappear. And Conan kept walking on his way. Very ominous warning. Apparently, I don't know, I guess the drug lords on the streets of Mexico are not happy with Chavo. Usually that doesn't end up very well. I'd be worried if I were Chavo. So he just kind of kept walking, or he went to go walk. But when he turned back around to continue walking down the hallway, there was Mil Muertes with Katrina, the former Maxine from WWE, who is his valet, and she said some ominous words to him, and then she licked the side of Chavo's face, which, that's basically a mark of death. It's like a kiss of death. When she licks you, bad things end up happening to you. So then they kept on walking, and Chavo was left to contemplate all of these people who apparently hate his guts all of a sudden. So the story they're telling is good. Again, just the person in the role to me is not the right person for it. But I like the way this was shot. I really do. It was like a dingy, dark, you know, like picture a hallway in like a horror movie, and you could hear like water dripping, and there's just like some lamps hanging from the ceiling, and it's kind of dark. You can't really see at the end of the hallway. It was like something out of a horror film. I like the way this was shot. I mean, I'm a really big fan so far of the production of this show. It makes it more like a movie, but it works. It just works. They had a segment that tried to explain the background, the history of this monster, Mil Muertes, who we just saw, and how he came to be the kind of person, the kind of monster I guess he is today. And again, cheesy, maybe, but I appreciate them telling the backstory. They told the story of this earthquake that hit Mexico in 1985, and they showed footage of the rubble after the earthquake had hit. And a lot of people died, including, I guess, his parents did. But all of a sudden, you see a young child, emerge from the rubble. That's supposed to be a young Mil Muertes. And he survived the catastrophe. And I guess seeing all this death and destruction around him and of his own family, he became more comfortable with the idea of death. And so that is part and parcel with his character. The whole thing about 1,000 deaths, right? They tried to explain it. They tried to explain his history and this traumatic event that happened and how it led him to be who he is today. Cheesy as it may have been, I appreciate the storytelling. I actually kind of like this. And that led to Mil Muertes in action next against Ricky Mandel. He basically killed Mandel, beat him with the flatliner. Not much to it. It was a classic squash match to put over Mil Muertes. So then we got another backstage segment. It was Castro and Cisco. They were outside Dario Cueto's office, kind of guarding the office. All of a sudden, the camera shows Johnny Mundo, John Morrison, coming very angrily marching down the hallway. And Castro and Cisco see him. They're like, "Hey, let's go over to this guy and find out what's going on here. Hey, you can't go in there." And what followed was, again, a scene out of a movie. It's the best way I can describe it. Is Mundo beat the hell out of him. And they kept cutting back to Dario Cueto in the office. He can kind of hear the commotion that was going on outside. He was very alarmed. Like, what the hell's going on out there? So Mundo made short work of those two, and he barged into the office. He actually dragged Cisco's body, like, into the office. And Cueto now is, like, really nervous. He's like, "Oh, wait a minute. Hold on now. Hold on." And Mundo says, "Hey, I'm not here to fight you. I'm not here to beat you up. You wanted violence? I like violence, too. We could work together." And he said, "All I want is a match against Big Rick." And Cueto said, "Okay, you got your match. You want your match against Big Rick? You got it." And Mundo went to leave, and then he stopped himself, and he turned back around, and he said, "After I get finished with him, I'm coming after you." And then all of a sudden, Cueto got really, really nervous again and kind of slinked back into his chair. I like the way this was done. I know I sound like a broken record here, but I think Dario Cueto, as the non-wrestler owner, who's an actor in real life, an actor from Spain that they found, he has been the breakthrough star of this show so far. I mean, he is, if you're going to do the tired heel authority figure shtick, it's refreshing to see him and his take on it. He's just really, really good. As long as they don't put him in the ring and have him take bumps and wrestle matches, we'll be okay. Later, we got another shot inside Cueto's office where Big Rick, he's giving Big Rick his big payoff, and Rick says, "That's not enough." He gives him more money. He says, "Listen, all you have to do, I'll give you whatever you want, just take this guy out next week. That's your job. Put Mundo in the hospital." And Rick looks at these stacks of $100 bills he's just been handed, and he kind of laughs and he leaves. So that's our main event for next week. We have Prince Puma hype video. And they show him riding a motorcycle and in the gym. I think part of the footage we saw here, we had seen in a previous video for him. But again, just a very good video building up Prince Puma as one of the top stars in the promotion. Then we had the main event, which was a three-way with Phoenix, Drago, and Pentagon Jr. Far too much stuff happened here for me to recap, but it was an awesome spot fest. That's the best thing I can say. I know some people are not really a fan of Mexican wrestling when it comes to matches like this. They just think it's a collection of spots as a match. There's no psychology to it. That's what Lucha Libre is. I mean, I'm not going to say there's no psychology to it, but a lot of those matches are like that. And I agree, I'm not really a big fan of it, but I thought for what these guys went in there and did, it was spectacular. It was one high spot after another. At one point, one of the guys did a dive off the balcony in the temple. They were doing all kinds of flips and dives. There was one really impressive move, and I wish I knew, I wish I remember who executed it. But it was something I had never seen before. And one guy came off the ropes, and it was almost like the other guy, when he caught him, was kind of pushing him off. But he pushed him off, and I can't even describe this. I'm doing a very poor job of describing this move. I wish I had taken notes on it when I saw it. But the point is, watch this match. There's a ton of action in it. Non-stop action. Really great stuff. And at the end of the day, it's called Lucha Underground for a reason, right? You've got to have Lucha. You've got to have Lucha. They call their matches Luchas. You know, the hot ring announcer they have. When she does the ring intros for the matches, she goes, "This next Lucha is scheduled for one fall." That's what they call them. You've got to have Lucha Libre on the show. And this was as good of a display of that as you're going to find. I think Phoenix won in the end. My notes on this match were not much. I literally had wrote, like, "This is awesome," and, like, general notes like that. I enjoyed the match. Like I said, it was action-packed. And I think if you're looking for some good action, definitely check it out. It was one of the, those matches this week where, like I said at the top of the podcast, a lot of good wrestling this week. From this three-way to the one on SmackDown and the stuff on NXT, and even Impact wasn't a bad show. You know, there's plenty of good wrestling to be found. And Lucha Underground, it's refreshing and nice to have just another option. A quick, easy, inoffensive, easy-to-follow, hour-long show with some good wrestling and good storytelling. What more can you ask for? Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com is the email address. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Too Cold Steve-O says, "I'm looking at the state of Cesaro's position at the moment, and he's just not going anywhere. Same with Swagger. As much as I love the guy, he's just not going to get as popular as he did when he was teaming with Cesaro." Well, he did when he wrestled Rusev. He says, "I know it sounds like a step back for Cesaro, but what if these two guys got back together? Think about it. You've said it yourself. There's a huge lack of babyface teams at the moment, and I think it would be very interesting to see a babyface run of the real Americans, and maybe a season of these guys teaming could be the recharge that they need. I know I would rather see these guys together challenging for the tag titles than see Cesaro come out with his lame music and lose over and over again." You know, I thought about this when I got the question, and I still think it's crazy that they can't come up with something sensible and meaningful for Cesaro to be doing as a singles guy. I never expected when the Real Americans broke up that Swagger was going anywhere. Swagger was, for lack of a better term, the Jannetty of that team. The plan was always for, or should have always been, to use that as a way to elevate Cesaro. Because Swagger had been around for so many years, and sometimes through his own fault, and other times through just the booking, he never went anywhere. They never really did anything with him. He had a very forgettable World Heavyweight title run after he cashed in Money in the Bank. This was all about Cesaro and pairing him off with Paul Heyman. I mean, the possibilities of what they could have done with him were just limitless. And they didn't do it. Why they didn't do it, I don't know. I don't know if it's just stupidity, if it just wasn't a priority, if Cesaro did something or said something to piss somebody off. I have no idea. But it didn't work out the way that a lot of fans were hoping that it would. Didn't lead to a Brock match. Didn't lead to anything. The idea that I would just take these two guys and put them back together would almost be like an admission of failure. And I just think there's so much potential with Cesaro as a single. I would hate to do it, but I would not be against the idea of putting the Real Americans back together. You know, and there's a way you can do it. You can figure out some way where they end up, you know, getting back together with Zeb as their manager. And yeah, absolutely, it would bolster the tag team division. You put them with the Usos, Golden Stardust. I mean, there's still rumors of the Ascension coming up sometime soon. What other team? Well, the Matadors don't count. Miz and Mizdow, if they want to keep them together as a team more often, that wouldn't be the worst idea in the world. So, I wouldn't be against the idea. I'd rather the two of them be together doing something than Cesaro be losing on SmackDown and Main Event and just on the sidelines doing nothing. I like the guy as a performer. I love watching him work. So if that means it gets him more television time, then you know what? Sure. I'd be okay with putting the Real Americans back together. But boy, what a sign of failure on WWE's part if they have to go that route. Ruben, how come WWE doesn't have 3-on-3 Survivor Series matches? Since WWE factions usually have three members, it would be much easier to book multiple Survivor Series matchups on the pay-per-view. In addition, you could utilize most of the roster by having the 3-on-3 Survivor Series matches rather than having one 5-on-5 match. What are your thoughts? I don't like the idea at all. The whole point of the Survivor Series is you get 8 guys or 10 guys in there. It's got to be 4-on-4 or 5-on-5. That's what the Survivor Series is. I see 6-man tag team matches up the yin-yang every single week on television. I see it on Raw, I see it on SmackDown, I see it on Impact. There is nothing unique or different or exciting about just doing more 6-man tag team matches, especially now that the Shield isn't around. When the Shield was around, then you had some exciting 6-man tag team matches. Now it's hit or miss, but we see them on television every week. Now, granted, it's not elimination style, that's true. That's the big wrinkle, that's the big difference. But it wouldn't be any different to me than watching Raw. 3-on-3. We see it every week. It betrays the whole point of what Survivor Series is. So, in other words, what you're saying is that since all factions are 3-on-3 these days, the Wyatts, the Shield, 3MB, right, we have a lot of threes. Just take those guys and put them in matches on the pay-per-view. I mean, think about the flaw in that logic, beyond what I just said about the fact that we always have 6-mans on television every week. The whole point of Survivor Series, it's unique in that we get to see those guys, even if they're friends, have to team up with other people that we would normally never see them team with. They did a match one year in 95, one of my favorite Survivor Series shows, in a year that was not a very good year for that company. But they did it, and they attributed it to Gorilla Monsoon, who was the on-air president at the time. Oh, Gorilla Monsoon came up with this concept of the wild card match. Gorilla Monsoon, I got to tell you, from a kayfabe perspective, his character on the air, he came up with some interesting concepts, from the wild card match that they never did again. I don't know why they never did it again. To the whole Raw's War concept. Remember, that was him. Next week, Gorilla Monsoon declares Raw is War. And ever since then, the show has had that look with the Titantron and the ramp. I still remember that. I still remember when they made the announcement and they attributed it to Monsoon. But to go back to my point, in 95 at Survivor Series, they did this wild card match. Now, the concept of the wild card match was it was just a mishmash of heels and faces paired up randomly as teams. So you had on one side Shawn Michaels, Ahmed Johnson, Psycho Sid, the British Bulldog. There may have been one other person, I can't remember. Sid and Michaels were, they used to be together, but they were sworn enemies at that point. Now they're on the same side. The other team had Dean Douglas and Razor Ramon and Owen Hart and Yokozuna. Razor may have been the only babyface on that team. But it was just unique. It was unique to see these guys forced to team up together. In some cases, bitter rivals had to be on the same side. And that's kind of the idea of Survivor Series. Not that exact one. Again, they haven't done that match since 95. But you're supposed to see guys out of their element paired up with guys they ordinarily would not be teamed with. Otherwise, it's just a boring 6-man tag. So I'm not a fan of that at all. Danny wants to know, based on what you have seen from Lucha Underground, has John Morrison improved in terms of his mic work? I wouldn't go that far, and I would caution you in that Lucha Underground is a very tightly produced show, and it's very different to say, okay, here are your scripted lines of dialogue in this backstage segment. We want you to beat up some guy, say a few lines to Dario, and then turn and leave. It's almost like a movie. I said it's shot like a movie, right? What has Morrison been doing a lot of since he left WWE? He's filmed a bunch of movies. And even some online web series stuff. But he was in Hercules. A lot of people may not know that. The Rock was in Hercules, right? What are you talking about? Well, around the same time, a indie-level B film was released as a Hercules movie with John Morrison as Hercules, not The Rock. And I watched it. And actually, it was what you would expect it to be. It was very cheesy. The acting and the dialogue were not very good. I enjoyed the action for what it was. It wasn't the worst movie I've ever seen or anything like that. But I watch Morrison in these movies and, he's fine. But that's not the same thing as being in front of a live crowd and given a mic and have to go out there and cut a 10-minute promo. We haven't seen that from Johnny Mundo so far. So the little bits and pieces we see of dialogue from him backstage, you can't go by that. I've seen nothing to tell me that he is any better at being a wrestling promo now than he was when he left in 2011. That was always my knock on him. I never knocked his work. I always knocked the fact that he was a terrible promo. Just, he was terrible. Everything sounded forced. Everything sounded phony coming out of his mouth. He sounded like a robot. And I've seen nothing that would prove me wrong. Maybe they'll give him the microphone next week or the week after, and he'll have to cut a promo, and he'll be better. But until I see him, I think, in a live environment with a mic, like on Raw, on a show like that, it's impossible to say. Because, again, this show is so tightly produced, and it's just, it's not the same thing. It's like shooting a movie. It's not cutting a wrestling promo. I haven't seen him cut a really good wrestling promo yet, so I would say no. Clyde from Dallas, I just watched Vengeance 2002, and it was a very interesting show to watch. Benoit and Guerrero were a tag team. Hogan was tag champ with Edge. John Cena's first pay-per-view match, the rise of Brock Lesnar, and a great triple threat match with Kurt Angle, The Rock, and The Undertaker. Do you feel this show is underrated? Also, where does that triple threat match rank in your favorite triple threats of all time? That is my favorite triple threat match of all time, now that you mention it. I am not a fan of triple threats, especially WrestleMania main events, when they've done triple threats and fatal four ways on occasion. I would always much rather it be a straight singles match. Generally speaking, though, I'm not really a fan, especially the way WWE does it, where it's one fall to a finish. I like the way they did it on SmackDown this week with Ziggler and Kidd and Cesaro, and I'd like to see him do it that way more often. But that match between Kurt Angle, The Rock, and The Undertaker at Vengeance, I wouldn't say the show itself is underrated. I'd have to go back and watch it on the network. I remember some of the matches you mentioned. I think that was the show where Hogan and Edge lost the tag belts to Christian and Lance Storm. And I know Cena had a match against Chris Jericho. So I do remember certain things from that show. But that was all about the main event. I won't say the show was underrated as much as I would say the main event is absolutely underrated. I don't hear hardly anybody talking about that match when they talk about great matches and great triple threats. It just kind of gets lost. And I remember watching it and thinking, holy shit, this was an awesome match. And I'd have to go back. It's been a while since I've watched it. I'd have to go back and see exactly what it was. I think it was the work and the near falls and the way they structured it, because a lot of those matches, they follow the same formula. You've got to get one guy out of the equation so it can be one-on-one. So one guy gets beat up or he gets put through a table. Now he's down, right? So now the other two are left to go one-on-one. Then eventually the other guy recovers, he comes back in, another guy takes a bump out of the ring, and now it's the other two guys. And it's the same formula over and over again. I like the way they handled the formula for their match. It was different. It was an exciting match. Like I said, the near falls, everything about it, the work, it was great. And that was the big evil version of The Undertaker against Kurt Angle, who was probably in his prime at that point, work-wise. And The Rock, who's pretty good, and it's just made for an excellent match. So where does it stand? It's probably my favorite triple threat match of all time. Philip from Kerrville, Texas. I was watching a video about New Japan Pro Wrestling on YouTube, and they brought up the Never Open Weight Championship. Maybe I'm just dumb, but I've never heard of this title. What is this championship? What is the significance of it, and how long has it been around for? Okay, so the Never title it's only about 2 years old. It's not that old. It started as something that would only be defended on certain shows that New Japan did where younger guys would fight for it. And what ended up happening was it just became something defended on the undercards. Okay, it was never like, I don't think a New Japan show has ever been headlined by a Never Championship match. So it just became part of the regular New Japan shows. They also didn't stick to the whole young man's belt concept, because the guys that have held it, they haven't been old, but they haven't been all that young either. Okay, like the current champion, Tomohiro Ishii, he's almost 40. He's not exactly a young up-and-comer. He's an established guy. He's an older guy. Along the way, it just became another title in New Japan. The open weight concept, it's not like there's a weight limit, so it's a little misleading, I guess, in terms of the name. But they have so many titles in that company. It's like everyone gets a belt. You get a belt. You get a belt. I'm a fan of less is more when it comes to titles, but it works for New Japan because every title actually means something there. If WWE wanted to add another mid-card title, I wouldn't like it because I'd rather they focus on making their current mid-card titles mean more. I think, like, if they do that then, and we've seen, actually, the last couple of weeks, kind of they've started to do that with the Intercontinental title. I can't say a week or two changes my mind. I mean, this is a long-term thing. Ask me in 3 months if I think they've elevated the Intercontinental title to some level of respect. They still haven't. Okay, those titles still don't mean a whole hell of a lot. But I feel like if WWE wanted to, okay, if they wanted to add a new belt, you've got to elevate the Intercontinental title and the U.S. title to something respectable first. Do that first. Then I might be more open to the idea of adding one more mid-card title or some kind of gimmicky title, not the hardcore title, but, you know, something like that, or a cruiserweight belt or something. But to me, the idea of adding more mid-card belts when you're existing to have generally been an afterthought makes no sense. Then what are you adding a third one for? So that's my take on titles, but as far as the never belt, that hopefully gives you a little history into it. There's not a whole lot of history there, and I think whatever original ideas they had for it have kind of fallen to the wayside. Utkarsh Raj from India. I was watching the 1992 Royal Rumble and thought the star of that match was Bobby the Brain Heenan. Right from the start of the Rumble to him freaking out when Ric Flair drew number 3, saying he was going to find it hard to be objective in this match, claiming that he would punch his grandmother in the nuts if he had to. I thought that he was the real star, and it made the Rumble that much more entertaining, so much so that I now consider it to be my favorite. Welcome to the club. I was wondering, what was your favorite call from Bobby Heenan on that night, and what are some of the greatest wrestling calls in general? Well, I'm a sucker for a good Bobby Heenan question, so you got me, you reeled me in here. I mean, as far as greatest general calls in wrestling, I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think about that. There's been so many of them from Jim Ross and even Vince. You know, that's gotta be Kane! I mean, there's been some classic calls before. But as far as Bobby Heenan, on that night, I couldn't isolate it to just one. I mean, the grandmother, I think the exact comment was, and this may have been after Jim Duggan or somebody low-blowed The Undertaker, and he was like, oh, he tried to lift The Undertaker. And he's like, he did, and Monsoon was like, he did not. Like, the way he said it was just hilarious. But yeah, I mean, Heenan was freaking out, and he made a comment at one point. He goes, hey, you gotta do what you gotta do. He goes, what was the comment? It was like, I'd do that to my grandmother if I had to. And again, Monsoon, it almost was like he was trying not to laugh. He's like, I bet you would. There was another point in the match where, you know, he was talking, The Barbarian, one of the many, many people that Heenan had managed throughout his career. And I think The Barbarian came out at one point, and he was talking about The Barbarian and what a monster he is and a maniac, and he was... You know, maybe there was some banter with him and Monsoon about the guy back and forth, but he was like, you know, they don't call on the Barbarian because he's a hairdresser on his days off, which I thought was great. And then he goes, you know, the Barbarian doesn't like anybody. He barely tolerated me when I managed him. So there was that. There was the stuff where he was saying, in the middle of the Rumble, the ring had cleared. So Big Boss Man kind of eliminated himself by jumping over the top rope. He missed Flair, and he went out over the top. And there were plenty of other guys that still hadn't come out yet, but Flair was the only one left in the ring. And Heenan's like, that's it. Just give him the title. And Monsoon's like, I'm not giving him the title. So then Piper comes out. I mean, the storytelling in this Rumble, don't get me going on this. I mean, this was just fantastic. But Piper and Jake Roberts had come out. And Piper was in the ring with Flair. And so I think Piper at one point, maybe Jake had gone after Flair. And so Piper went after Jake, who was this dastardly heel at that point. This was in the middle of the feud with Randy Savage. And so, in effect, Piper actually helped Flair at that moment. And Heenan was like, oh, Piper, he goes, it's not a skirt, it's a kilt. It's not a skirt, it's a kilt. And then, of course, like a minute later, not even a minute later, Piper starts kicking Flair, and now that I think about it, it may have been Flair in the figure four by Greg Valentine, but in any event, Piper starts kicking Flair, and of course Heenan's like, it's not a kilt, it's a skirt, you skirt-wearing freak, and I mean, I could just go on and on about how awesome Bobby Heenan was in that match, and that was a big part of the story. The commentary on that night enhanced the story they were trying to tell. Every time Flair was in jeopardy and looked like he might be dumped out, Heenan was on the verge of having a heart attack. And he would tell somebody off camera, go get me some water. And, oh, Flair wins this, I promise I'll never do or say anything bad ever again. And on and on and on to the final call of the match when Flair dumped out Sid. Hulk Hogan, the big crybaby sore loser that he is, helped eliminate Sid, who was perfectly within reason dumping Hogan out of the ring. It's every man for himself. Apparently, Hogan felt differently, and he saw fit to eliminate Sid, the big crybaby that he is. But when that happened, and you know, Heenan's like, yes, yes, people talk about the yes chant. The very first yes chant came from Bobby the Brain Heenan on this show. And he's just, yes, yes, yes. And you've got Monsoon, who's the straight babyface announcer, even he is forced to admit, you know, what a man, Ric Flair, he did it, I can't believe it, he gave him his just desserts. And that right there is an example of how you put somebody over. Whether they're a heel or a face, when they accomplish something like that, you've got the babyface announcer siding with the heel announcer, putting over this great feat, this great accomplishment that this guy just achieved. Just everything about that match was just pitch perfect. And Heenan's commentary was as much a part of it as anything. I could go back and practically, I know the verbiage in my head before he even says it. And it never gets old to me. I can go back and watch that match over and over. And I try to watch it at least once a year, like around Rumble time, which means I'll probably watch it again very soon on the network. It's just fantastic. Mitch from Bakersfield, California. I've read that Chris Benoit was once WCW champion for a day. What is the story behind his one-day title run? Very simple. They did not want to lose him to WWE. They were trying to make him happy. Kevin Sullivan was the booker at that point. There was no love lost between Sullivan and Benoit. Benoit was married at that point to a woman who was Kevin Sullivan's ex-wife. So you can imagine some of the tension there between the two of them. And Benoit was convinced that as long as Sullivan had the book, you know, he was never going to get anywhere in that company, and he was going to be booked poorly, he was going to be buried. He wanted out. He wanted out of that company. So they put the belt on him. I think it was at the Sold Out pay-per-view. He beat Sid with the crossface. But they did the finish in such a way where I think Sid's foot was like under the rope. That was kind of their out if anything happened. And of course, the next day, Benoit left. He got his release, as did Guerrero, Malenko, and Saturn. And I think they did end up going back to that footage. Oh, the foot was under the rope, and that's how they... I think they may have put the belt back on Sid. I don't remember exactly how they resolved that. But that's what it was, straight up. Benoit wanted out. They tried to make him happy. They put the belt on him. That wasn't enough. He left anyway. And that was the story. Robert from Kissimmee, Florida. Four of my all-time favorite wrestlers are Rowdy Roddy Piper, Jake the Snake Roberts, Macho Man Randy Savage, and The Undertaker. They all work well both as heels and as babyfaces. How would you evaluate them in regard to which among them worked best as a heel and which among them worked better as a babyface? The simple answer is I think all of them work better as heels. If I had to pick one of the bunch who... maybe I'd say, okay, of the bunch, he probably was a better babyface. Probably The Undertaker. Although when The Undertaker was a heel, even like when he was Big Evil, I mean, he was pretty badass. But maybe I'd say Undertaker then. I mean, Jake, by far, was a better heel. Randy Savage, by far, was a better heel. Roddy Piper. A little closer, maybe, but I still think better as a heel. And I'm talking like old school Piper back when he was feuding with Hogan back during that period. Awesome, awesome heel. The timing wasn't right, but absolutely could have been a WWF champion at that time. But Hogan was around at the same time, and Hogan was their new top guy, and he had the belt. So I think if the timing was different, Piper absolutely would have been a great heel world champion, but he was never going to get the belt because Hogan was first coming up with it at that time. And then Undertaker, like I said, I probably would say of the four, he probably would have been, I regard him as a better babyface, but I still feel like all of them are probably better heels than they were babyfaces. You could say that about a lot of guys. You know, Bret Hart, I would say a guy like Bret Hart, as great as he was as a heel in the U.S.-Canada feud in 1997, Bret Hart is a guy I will always say is a much better babyface. Just in terms of his work and the spots, he could get his ass kicked so believably. And then he made a comeback, and you could just get into his matches, you know? And when you're a heel, you got to work differently. And I just feel like Bret was the ultimate babyface. He was so great. So a guy like him, I would say, yes, better babyface than a heel. But the four that you mentioned, probably all better as a heel, to be honest with you. So two more here. T-Bats writes in, was it the original plan to have The Undertaker debut at the Survivor Series in 1990? Because I've seen pictures online of Bad News Brown on Ted DiBiase's team. Well, you know, it's funny you mention that. I had never really heard otherwise. So I looked into it, and this is all news to me. And sure enough, on WWE.com, they have a gallery up of Survivor Series teams that never were. And one of the photos they have up was from some photo shoot they did. And it shows Ted DiBiase with Rhythm and Blues and Bad News Brown. And actually, in Bad News Brown, one of his hands is a wad of dollar bills. So I can't tell you for sure that the original plan was for him to be in that Survivor Series match, because it's entirely possible that they knew it was going to be a mystery person, and they just wanted him to be in the shot so they can silhouette his image. I don't buy that. I look at this photo, I see him with the money in the hand. My guess is this. This is what I think happened. Bad News Brown left the company. It was probably very soon after SummerSlam that year in 1990. I think at SummerSlam he had a match with Jake Roberts, I believe. It was like the snake against the rat, because Bad News Brown would bring like a New York City street rat in a cage to the ring with him. And I think it was around that time that he probably would have found out what his payday was for WrestleMania. And I had always read and a bit of the understanding that he was very upset with his payoff for his WrestleMania match that year against Roddy Piper. That was the match where Piper dressed half black, which, can you imagine them pulling a stunt like that these days? Piper, I think I remember reading he got paid like $50,000 for that match. Bad News Brown, suffice to say, did not get paid nearly as much. He was very upset about that. So he has the match at SummerSlam that year, and then he leaves, and it had to do with money. Now, back then, WWE actually would plan things out well in advance. I know, what a shocking revelation. It's impossible to believe these days, but they did. Times were different back then. I believe they probably did have Bad News Brown in mind for a spot on DiBiase's team. But then, after they shot all the promo stuff, he left the company. And so they came up with a new battle plan, which was, we have this new character, let's debut him as a mystery man at the pay-per-view. Because think about it, he looked really out of place in that match, The Undertaker did. I mean, you had Bret Hart, Dusty Rhodes, Jim Neidhart, I forgot the other guy, against DiBiase, Greg Valentine with the slick black hair, Honky Tonk Man. All of a sudden, here comes The Undertaker, who, by the way, I think got counted out in the match. I think he pinned Dusty Rhodes, and then he got counted out. It was a very unimpressive debut for The Undertaker in some ways. He just seemed very out of place. So I tend to believe that version of the story, that it was going to be Bad News Brown. We now have photographic proof that he was at least pictured as part of that team, which is really cool to see, because, you know, you think you know everything, right? You really don't know nearly everything about, you know, things like that. So I learn something new every single week when it comes to stories like that. And I saw that, I'm like, wow, I never saw that. I never knew that before. And then he left, and I think Undertaker was probably a backup plan. I don't know what his debut would have looked like otherwise. Probably would have just debuted him in a match on Superstars. But yeah, interesting stuff. And lastly here, Joseph from Connecticut. What do you think was their better feud? Chris Jericho versus Shawn Michaels from 2003 or Jericho versus Shawn Michaels from 2008? There's only a five-year difference, but with the 2003 feud, we got their WrestleMania 19 classic, while in 2008, we had that great ladder match. Which do you think is better? You're asking me better feud. I mean, I don't think there's any comparison whatsoever. I think the feud in 2008, by leaps and bounds, was better, because the feud in 2008 is one of the best feuds in the history of WWE. And I've been going back recently and watching more of that stuff from that feud while I'm reading Jericho's book, because in his new book, he talks a lot about the feud with Michaels, and each of the matches and the meticulous planning that went into it. And in some cases, the not-so-meticulous planning that went into it. These two guys were so damn good at what they did, it wasn't rocket science. They can come up with a simple plan and execute it, and it just worked. So he talks a lot about that feud in his new book, which, by the way, you can pick up the audio version of Jericho's book using our Audible URL, audibletrial.com/Solomonster, cheap plug. But that feud, you know, I went back and watched the street fight at Unforgiven, which was the night that Michaels got his revenge and he beat Jericho, and he beat the hell out of Jericho in that match. I mean, they really laid it in, and Jericho was all busted up and cut up. And then he kind of sneaks back out there at the end of the show and wins the world title in the scramble match. I just thought that was really well done. That then led to the ladder match in October, but they had a series of matches that year, all of which were, at the very least, good. And in terms of the ladder match, that's one of the best ladder matches in WWE history. I mean, according to Jericho, Vince McMahon himself decreed it the best ladder match up to that point in WWE history, which is pretty high praise. I can't disagree. I might have to think about that and really go back and look at some of the great ladder matches that they've had. But it's way up there if it isn't number one. So you're talking about a feud that, you know, yielded at least one of potentially the company's greatest matches. And the storytelling and the angles they did from the moment that Jericho rammed that Geritron 6000 or whatever it was into Michael's face, which was so poetic if you think about it, because you think back to the barbershop, right? When Michaels first broke away as a single star, and what did he do? He turned on his partner and he threw him through the plate glass window. Well, all these years later now, Michaels has this glass or fake glass television set rammed into his face, and they did the whole thing where his eye was all messed up and he might have to retire. And, you know, he tells the story in the book, you know, McMahon wanted the two of them to have a match at SummerSlam. And they were like, no, you can keep this going, man. Why don't we just play this up and we'll pretend like Michaels is going to announce his retirement, but I'll come out. And they came up with the whole idea for the angle with his wife, which turned a little more real than they had intended it to be. But, I mean, best feud in this company probably in the last decade. Are you kidding me? It was awesome. And I don't find myself going back to the year 2008 very often, getting nostalgic and watching stuff. If I'm going back in time on the network and watching stuff, I'm watching stuff from the 90s. I'm watching stuff from the 80s, maybe the early 2000s, maybe. But here I am going back to fucking Unforgiven in 2008, which is a show I had completely forgotten about. And I'm watching this stuff and I'm like, God damn, this stuff is really awesome. Jericho, that whole period was awesome. You know, even the stuff with Rey, I went back and watched the match he had with Rey Mysterio in 09 when Jericho won the Intercontinental title and ripped Rey's mask off. Jericho was on fire during that whole period. That, like, two-year period there was easily the best period of his career in terms of his performance, his character, his matches. I'd put that up against anything he did in WCW or his first run in WWE. If you have questions for the mailbag, keep emailing me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I am very much backlogged, but I do go through everything you send to me. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I do live tweet during Raw on Monday nights and other big shows and pay-per-views, so you'll want to follow me on there. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the link to my profile page. And we also have a fan page. If you type in Solomonster Sounds Off, we have a group page and a fan page. What you'll want to do, if you want to get access to our group page, you've got to go to the fan page first. And like our page. Once you do that, if you apply for membership, I will approve you to our private discussion group. But from now on, you've got to like that fan page first. So I know you are an active listener of the show. You'll like the page and you'll be approved. So be sure to do that. And we've got some great discussion going on in the group. And hopefully you can be part of it. We also have a YouTube page, youtube.com/TheSolomonster. If you can't get enough Sound Off, there's bonus Sound Off content up on that channel right now. Bonus videos, reviews of events and DVDs and shoots and all that kind of stuff. And there's more going up in the very near future. So if you are not already a subscriber, one of the 10,000 plus subscribers on our channel on YouTube, please subscribe. And remember, if you want to support the podcast, there's three different ways to do it. You can make a direct PayPal donation to the show. Go on thesolemonster.com. You'll see the donation box on the right-hand side. You can give whatever you want, however often you want. We have a lot of people who don't just contribute, but they contribute on a regular basis. And that's really cool. And I really want those people to know more than anything else that I appreciate that continued support. So you can make a donation, or you can sign up for an Audible trial. I know I've mentioned that numerous times on this show. Audibletrial.com/Solemonster, whether it's Chris Jericho's new book or some completely unrelated book. You get one free audiobook as part of your 30-day trial of the service, so just use our URL. And you can go on ProWrestlingTees.com/Solemonster Sounds Off and do some Sound Off shopping. We have 10 different t-shirts with more on the way. So please do consider buying a shirt in our store. They ship international, all over the world, in multiple sizes and multiple colors. And you can also pay via PayPal, credit card, or debit card. So that's going to do it for this week's episode of The Sound Off. We will be back next weekend with a Survivor Series preview and predictions. And I guess by then we'll know if there's been any new breaking news on the TNA TV front. So we'll have all that coming up next weekend. Until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the week. And we will see you right back here for a brand new Sound Off next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Happy Lee, I had to sit in the stands and watch Granny break a wine bottle over another woman's ass. What a classy lady. And I loved how she went for the cheap pop by pleading with everybody,
"My mother was born in Brooklyn."
As if that's supposed to impress all of us. Guess what? It didn't. They got exactly the reaction they deserved. And the next morning on the Today Show, they talked about their experience. Happy Lee claimed that she was against appearing on the show in the first place. She had to be convinced to do it. This is all coming from a woman who once made an autistic kid cry on national television. There's a lot of dumb shit this woman has said over the years that should have earned her a lifetime ban from television. She's got no business being on TV. Why is she employed? Why does she have a job? The picture of class, Kathy Lee Gifford.
Since 2007, The Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster Sound Off.